Blog Talk Radio.
To be the man, you gotta beat the man.
You wanna find out how good you are? You're looking at the man's shit. Let's go hook him up!
Another edition of Over the Top Radio. I am your host, Ed, in San Antonio, and I'm joined by my co-host, Katrina. What's going on, Katrina?
Not much.
Not too much, yeah. Pretty much the same here. We're short a co-host tonight. He claims it's his wife's birthday, but I'm only assuming he just doesn't want to look like an idiot again after the last two shows. And if you go back and listen to the MP3, I mean, I was shocked when he was and appalled when he confused Tom Zink with Rick Martel as being Teal Santana's partner in Strike Force. But if you listen to the MP3 link, you actually hear him continue saying he was a former AWA world champion.
Inexcusable.
Yeah, I mean, we should have thought about kicking him off the show for good after that comment, because that... I couldn't even see Brian Hours making that stupid of a comment. But we have our replacement co-host on the line, so we're replacing Craig with, well, I don't want to say another jerk, because compared to this guy, Craig's not really a jerk, but what's going on, Shemp?
What's happening? A massive improvement on a Friday night.
Not too much, man. We're just here with nothing else to do, and hopefully... we will finally put to rest this whole Starcade history or whatever we're doing tonight. So,
yeah, we're
going to
wait. We're getting through the shitty years here. Yeah, we're getting through the shitty years.
Yeah, so
I was looking at the results for this. I barely remember any, like, 92 or 93.
Yeah. There's not much.
Yeah, it's a few shows that you really want to put behind you, and it's kind of sad considering it's still, at that point, wasn't it still the main pay-per-view of WCW
yeah.
at the time?
Yeah.
Yeah. But I guess we could go ahead and start already.
Okay.
So I think last time we stopped at the first Battle Bowl, so we're up to Battle Bowl number 2.
Yeah, the Starrcade 92 Battle Bowl, they at least had some sense this year to include, like, some title matches and other matches instead of just, like, you know, just the format of nothing but Battle Bowl matches. So that was good.
Oh, absolutely. You look at the, like, if you look at just the results of, like, who, you know, the people that were on the card, you'd think it was, like, this epic thing. When you know, with Muda and with some of the names, but it's just, it was... Again, and maybe my memory's not that great, but it was just relatively forgettable. I mean, if I remember right, Douglas and Windham or Douglas and Steamboat against Windham and Tillman was good. But outside of that, I mean, even the stuff, and I love Great Muda. And I kind of remember the Muda-Chono match. I mean, the rest of it, I mean, Van Hammer and Danny Spivey beat Johnny B. Badden Cactus Jack in the opener. Who remembers that?
I know you remember Dan Spivey being there at the time until you mentioned it.
He was in and out. He had like the Japan deal, I think, at that time. So he was coming in and coming out. And that actually
one thing that hurt the Great Muto Chono match is they showed the Japan match, if I'm not mistaken, right before this match on TV. And that was one hell of a match.
Yeah, the NWA title tournament.
Yeah.
They had the match there. And then they were changing the title like the next week, weren't they? At the big January Tokyo Dome show?
I'm not too sure. Don't we have our Japanese expert on the line?
Well, I'm trying to remember, like, the NWA title history at that time, too, because it was, what, Rick? Crazy, when did Rick Rude have it? Let me actually go back and see.
Rude won it the next year in 93. Remember when they had the big dispute and it was just called the big old belt after that? No, but I think Muto won the NWA title like a few days later, and that it was the next WCW Japan Super Show at the Tokyo Dome.
Yeah, the Tokyo Dome show, that's right. And then he ended up losing it to Barry Windham.
Yeah.
And then he turned around and lost it to Flair. I think that was when they were teasing, too. And for this, that's the next year, 93. But isn't that when they were teasing? Like, there's a former world champion who's blonde, who's like 6'8", coming in, and they kept teasing Hulk Hogan, and out came Barry Windham looking big.
Yeah, that was the year after. That was like in 94, right before Hogan came in. So.
And this is also the year that Barry Windham started to get fat.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he was still awesome, but he was starting to get fat this year.
I wonder in between which like run in WWF now. When he came back this time, was he the Stalker, or was he there the whole time? I'm trying to remember because there was a Widowmaker. I think that was when the Brainbusters were there. There was the Stalker. There was all this other random stuff with Barry Windham at that time, going in and out of WWF.
Yeah, the Stalker was like 96. So. Yeah, and the Widowmaker was like 89, and then he just disappeared altogether when his dad and his brother got a pop for counterfeiting.
I remember that.
Anyway, the first match was Van Hammer, Dan Spivey, beat Johnny B. Badd and Cactus Jack, and they actually did the drawing like the month before at the Clash of the Champions for this match. So, not exactly a match made me by this pay-per-view, so.
Now, you had two very popular characters in Cactus Jack and Johnny B. Badd, and they jobbed Van Hammer and Dan Spivey.
Johnny B. Badd, Cactus Jack, and a little program after that. So, that's why that happened.
Yeah, the music battle. Wasn't Axel Rotten? I got to remember Axel Rotten was, I think he faced off against Van Hammer at that time, too.
Oh, that was
around that time.
That was PN News like the year before.
Okay. See, this whole, you know, era is just complete downtime for me.
In the next match, you had Big Van Vader and Dustin Rhodes beat Kintsugi Sasaki and Barbarian. Sounds like might be a decent match. I don't really remember it, though.
It was a good match. I thought Dustin and Vader actually made a good team.
Yeah, no memory of this whatsoever.
Okay, let's go to the next match, which actually sounds tremendous. It's Great Muto and Barry Windham beat Brian Pillman and Too Cold Scorpio, which was weird because Windham and Pillman were going to team up for the tag team championships later on in the show. So,
and now, if I remember right, that was a pretty good match, but it was really short. Ridiculously short. And I know they had to do that in, you know, the tag matches to kind of speed them along, but it was like, you know, these are four guys I actually want to see wrestle each other, and it just, again, was way too short.
Yeah. The next match, you had Steve Williams and Sting defeated Jushin Liger and Eric Watts.
Somebody doesn't belong there.
Who the hell did Liger piss off for both years to be fucking stuck in such shitty matches?
Hey,
I mean,
don't walk in like Japanese guys jumping around.
But fuck Eric Watts, give me a fucking break.
Well, those Japanese guys did a lot of flippy-do moves and things like that, so, you know. you had to make New Japan happy so you couldn't get them beat. But, you know, we're going to stick you with Bill Watts being there with my boy Eric. And this,
and
this goes 10 minutes. The one before this goes 7. Does that make sense?
No, not really.
I didn't really mind. Like, I didn't think Eric Watts was that bad. It's just he got pushed down everybody's throat so much. It was just terrible.
It was, you know, okay, I'll tell you exactly what totally fucked up the Eric Watts thing. Because if they took it a little easier, it might have gone over. As soon as they did that fucking gas station brawl where he kicked Arn's ass, that was it. Everyone
was
turned
awesome.
On him. Everyone was like, fuck you.
I remember that. The girl was, her dad had the video camera at the gas station, took a picture with Eric Watts, and Arn Anderson showed up in his Zubaz pants and then jumped him. And he put
the
SPF on
him
right there.
The little kid's like, it's pointing, it's Arn Anderson, or he said something. I just remember the little kid trying to warn him. But fucking poor Arn got fucking, he looked pretty stupid at the end of this one.
Yeah. The next match you had, the NWA and WCW Tag Team Champions Shane Douglas and Ricky Steamboat beat Barry Windham and Brian Pillman in 20 minutes. This is probably the best match on the show. I really like Shane Douglas and Steamboat as a tag team.
Yeah, they were actually pretty good. Great matches.
I know Douglas always gets a bad rap because, you know, him being so obnoxious in ECW and everything, but then, you know, just being so over the top with bashing Flair and you know, everything else that's happened in his life since then. But, I mean, you know, Shane Douglas was, you know, I remember him in Mid-South. He had just started out. And then remember him here. And it was him and Steamboat were actually really, really good together. I mean, really good together. And so were Windham and Pillman in the, you know, little bit of time that they were teaming. But, I mean, Shane Douglas always gets a bad rap. But at that time, I mean, even throughout the Dynamic Dudes thing, as crappy as that was, I mean, it wasn't like it was his fault. It was like you still saw the dude with talent. So it was actually nice a couple years later, you know, after that big abortion, which is coming back to life now in 2011 with Johnny Ace. You know, it was actually, you know, in that little time, it was actually good to see because I really liked Douglas, at least then.
Yeah, that thing kind of reminded me of Steamboat and Youngblood from the 80s.
Well, I don't know if I go that far.
I wouldn't go that far, but they had great matches until I don't know what happened where something happened with Shane Douglas to where they had to do like the Conquistador gimmick, and I can't even remember what their name was, but it ended up being like a big match in a cage, and it ended up being Steamboat and Zinc as a team, and I knew it was Zinc like 30 seconds into the match.
Yeah,
and I just remember after the match, after Zink did the job, Ricky fucking pulled the mask off real right away, so no one knew it was him getting pinned.
In the next match, you had Sting defeated Big Van Vader in 16 minutes to win the King of Cable tournament. This is actually the other best match on the show, I thought.
Yeah,
they were
tournament being really weird. It was, you know, I think it was all TBS and everything, but they would talk about it on the syndicated shows, but it was wacky. It was just, you know, really kind of wacky, and it was, I don't know. It wasn't as bad as, like, the King of the Ring was, because obviously the people in it, and they treated it with, you know, some semblance of respect and everything, but I just remember it was kind of for that time with some of the people that were in it and some of the matches you see week after week. It was kind of like, eh. It was nice it was Sting and Vader at the end, though. And that's, here's one where Sting, you know, Sting can't work and all this other stuff. I always thought Sting and Vader were actually really good. I know Adam, you know, always loved those matches, you know, even more than I did. But, you know, I always thought Sting gets a bad rap because it's not like he was, you know, just had handles on him and Flair carried him everywhere. I thought Sting and Vader was actually really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sting and Vader had awesome chemistry together. I mean, they used to just beat the shit out of each other. And their matches really look good.
I think Sting's best opponents were probably Vader, Flair, and I'd say Cactus Jack as well. They had great matches too.
Yeah, actually they did, and Muda. I mean,
yeah,
Sting and Muda together at that point. I mean, both of their careers with the language barrier and all of that stuff. I mean, that they were really awesome too.
Yeah,
and I just remember in this match, It's pretty awesome because they did the whole rope-a-dope thing where Big Van Vader was punching himself out. This thing was just taking shots, and Vader was getting winded, and that was pretty good. Then you had WCW World Champion Ron Simmons beat Steve Williams by disqualification. This was originally going to be Rick Rude, but that's when Rude had his, I guess he had herniated disc or something, so he had to leave for a while. So they stuck Steve Williams in. And originally it went to a double count out, but then Steve Williams attacked him after the match, and they reversed the decision. Which, if you got a double count out, I don't know why you bother reversing the fucking decision. It's kind of
law and order under Bill Watts in WCW, son. Referee's decision is never final. He'll overturn it. And no mats on those floors either.
Then you had NWA World Champion Masachono defeated Great Muta by submission in about 12 minutes. This wasn't much of a match.
I remember very little of it. It just, you know, again, two guys I really liked and really liked at that timeline. I really don't remember the match.
Yeah.
Like I say, I remember the one in Japan so much more.
And then they had the big battle bowl at the end, and the Great Muta won the battle bowl, which was the battle royal in 14 minutes. I was surprised Muta won because he wasn't there regularly, so that's kind of weird.
No, and that's what, for me, it's not like I was reading newsletters or anything at that time, and if it wasn't on like a random 900 liner on a radio talk show, I didn't hear about it, so it's just like, you know, I wouldn't have, you know, it was, obviously New Japan politics obviously played a heavy role in this, and New Japan at that time was, hey, they were rolling huge. The fact that they could actually book the Tokyo Dome and fill it up, you know, year after year, they were living pretty good at that time. So, you know, in hindsight, you know, the last two matches especially make sense, and the finishes of the other ones now make sense more, too. It's not like Kensuke was getting pinned in that match with the Barbarian.
Then we move on to Starrcade 1993 on December 27th in Charlotte, North Carolina. This was a one-match show. There's really nothing else on this show. This was Rick
Flair
and Vader with Flair's career on the line.
Yeah, but that was awesome. I just remember fucking Vader. Like, Flair's punching Vader in the face, and you just hear Vader mumbling to him, "Hit me again! Hit me again!" It was awesome.
Yeah, they had Harley Race being there too. I mean, it was cool with Flair coming back because they baited it, and obviously being a longtime Mid-Atlantic NWA guy, you know, Flair coming back was a big deal, and then, you know, the fact it was going on all summer and everything, and you know, him coming back and beating Vader, you know, title first career was awesome, absolutely awesome.
And the matches on this one, you had pretty wonderful, though Paul Orndorff and Paul Roma beat Marcus Bagwell and Too Cold Scorpio. And before this match, they gave the Manager of the Year award to Teddy Long, and then his team lost. So I don't know what that says.
And I remember the tag team of Pretty Wonderful. I have no recollection whatsoever of Jody Hamilton, the assassin, being next to him.
Yeah, he was there. He was there a few times. I remember he was with Paul Orndorff, and I wonder if we did some stuff with Dustin Rhodes, and they had Dusty Rhodes in Dustin's corner, and it kind of migrated over to the thing with Paul Roma. And I liked Marcus Bagwell and Too Cool Scorpio. I thought they were a decent team at the time.
Yeah, they were pretty good. I liked them.
Like male strippers, like the Kenny King and Red Titus of their time. And actually, in Too Cold Scorpio's case, I guess he pretty much all but was a male stripper for, you know, like 97 kids spread out across the world. Oh, it sounded ironic that he would team in Noah with a guy by the name of Richard Slinger, old Dick Slinger.
Oh. In the next match, I don't know why this match is on, the Shockmaster pinned King Kong in 1 minute and 34 seconds.
Wait, the who? Oh, the Shockmaster.
The Shockmaster.
And who did he pin? Awesome Kong?
King Kong.
King Kong. But that was like one of the Awesome Kongs, wasn't it?
Yeah. He had
Awesome Kong. That dude with a mask, and he had like, he used to wear those things on his boots like the chicks wear at the fucking clubs now.
It was horrible.
That's it. They were just, I remember just two big dudes. And that's about it. And
the
Vader killed them.
And they had to make part of the, you know, the gimmick here that, you know, he can't get in the ring without falling down because of the big live moment of the Clash of the Champions a few months earlier. Which was
unreal.
I watched the Legends of Wrestling Roundtable, and they were doing the worst characters, and they were talking about the Shockmaster, and Dusty Rhodes was there. And they said, whose idea was this? And Dusty just raised his hand. And that was his brother-in-law. And he said that Cody was at home watching this Clash of the Champions, and when he fell through the wall and mask came off, he said, "Hey, that's Uncle Fred."
This. And then for a while after that, they did try to do like the crazy Uncle Fred Ottman. You know, he's just a goofy guy.
I actually saw him. He wrestled here in San Antonio for a brief time. It was at the same time that Shawn Michaels was teaming with Paul Diamond as the American Force. And his name was like the Terminator or something, and he pretty much wrestled in just jeans and a shirt or whatever, but he actually looked like he had potential. It was going to be like had potential to be like a star. And then I guess after Tugboat and the Shockmaster, I guess he never was anything other than just a big goof.
Because he took off his Hulk Hogan friendship bracelet.
Yeah.
Ed goes and sees matches. Shawn Michaels is in one, and the Shockmaster is in the other one. And he takes Uncle Fred's thing, and he's going to be the star.
In the next match, he had WCW TV Champion Steve Regal went to a draw Ricky Steamboat. This may have been decent. I don't remember.
It was pretty good. I remember it. It was actually very, very good.
Oh, God, yeah. And I think they had a couple matches on Saturday night as well. Regal was rolling at that time. I think it was around then he had some really good matches with Flair and maybe a little after that did the Queensberry Rules thing or whatever
yeah.
It was. And the stuff with Steamboat, too. I mean, it was just – I always loved Steamboat anyway. And Regal, it was just like – I loved his character, too, because he was such a pro. And then – Dundee as Sir William kind of bouncing around there, and once in a while he'd have, like, Lord Littlebrook running around. It was just, his whole thing at that time was awesome. I know it was, you know, dated or whatever, but, you know, you can tell the way he's updated it now to being smug in a suit and everything. It was just, that was awesome even then.
I think he looks old, yeah. Looked older in 1993 than he does now.
It's amazing how much of the long hair actually helps him now.
Yeah. Then you had Cactus Jack and Max Payne defeated Tex Slasinger and Shanghai Pierce. Tex Slasinger and Shanghai Pierce, they were like the Zack Ryders at this time because they had their segment of fans in the center stage every week. Cheerful.
I actually liked them. And, you know, you had to like them because it was like where at least they stood out because they weren't your – they were jobbers who weren't your everyday jobbers. Like every once in a while they'd get a win. But for the most part, they job, but it's like with the gimmick and everything, it was actually, it was pretty cool. At least it stood out. And the only thing I really remember about this is they also killed each other because it was Cactus Jack and Max Payne, and they all just beat the shit out of each other.
I remember Cactus and Max Payne were, I really liked them as a tag team, but my God, I always hated Max Payne's outfit, dude. He I don't know why he was wearing those spandex, dude.
Was it Cactus or Max Payne or Cactus and Kevin Sullivan that had the match with the Nasty Boys where it was this,
Max Payne
this,
in Philadelphia?
Yeah, that was Kevin Sullivan in Philadelphia.
Oh, that's because David Schultz was the special referee.
Yeah, Dave the Hammer Schultz.
That's awesome. No. Okay.
Well, didn't they also have one where it was Cactus and Max Payne against the Nasty Boys?
Yeah, they had an awesome street fight in Chicago the month before.
Okay, well, that's what I was thinking about.
I just remember after that match in Philadelphia, you know, that was at Slamboree and, you know, the Legends thing. And right after they just had this hardcore match, they interviewed Vern Gagne. He said, "I don't know what's going around here, but I don't want to see a match like that ever again." Then you had WCW.
And then he killed a man.
He killed him. WCW International World Champion which was the name they gave the title after the NWA kind of, you know, kind of took their name off, was Rick Rude pinned the Boss, who was the Big Boss Man.
They could only use half the name, dude. God damn.
The Boss.
This is when he was starting to, he was awesome as Big Bubba. He was awesome as the Big Boss Man in WWE. But this is when he was starting to slowly go downhill.
Yeah. I think WCW does that to you. He was good at WWF, and WCW wasn't much.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it was the Boss, and then the Guardian Angel, and then just the Angel, wherever the hell it was. It just got ridiculous there. And it was amazing when he came back. Remember when he came back to WWF as Vince McMahon's bodyguard when he was in the wheelchair, and he just had on, like, the black mask and the all black. Like, all of a sudden, it's almost like Mark Henry. All of a sudden, he's, like, instantly credible again with the nightstick. Now, of course, that led to no magic, but still. Well, that's what, yeah, I mean, it didn't last long, but at least you had that one little glimpse of it back after, like, he and John Kenta were fighting in that Carson City Silver Dollar match.
The next match, you had Steve Austin beat Dustin Rhodes in 15 minutes in a 2-out-of-3-fall match for the U.S. title. This was the second best match on the show, I think.
That might have been the best match on the show.
No, Flair Vader was better.
Yeah, oh yeah, that's true. But yeah, Austin and Dustin were fucking awesome together.
Yeah.
Or, Austin and like Wyndham also. I mean, Austin was just having awesome matches with all the guys at this point. Him and Steamboat. I mean, he was really tearing it up as a worker at this point. It was probably his best as being a pure worker was at this point.
Yep.
Oh yeah, and it was just like it was such a clean ascension up too from like world class when he started off with Chris Adams like that feud. It was like. You could tell he was good, and then he goes over there, and it just was like he never declined. And at no point did he decline until he got hurt there for that little bit, and he ended up getting fired.
I remember I was kind of happy when he joined the Dangerous Alliance, but at the same time, I just remember being very, very sad that Lady Blossom's big, giant titties went away.
She was hot.
She was damn hot. She was fucking porn star hot at the time.
Then in the next match, you had Sting and Road Warrior Hawk beat WCW Tag Team Champions, the Nasty Boys, via DQ in 29 minutes and 11 seconds, which is way too long for these guys to go.
Speaking of porn star hot, Missy Hyatt was there.
Yeah.
Nothing from Ed? Nothing?
She was nice to me the last time we communicated, so I don't want to fuck it up. But, yeah, she was looking very fine at that time. I'll never forget that fucking beach blast or whatever. I just remember that was so absurd, though, because the bikini she had on first had way more materials than the bikini she came out on second, which was the one that was supposed to shock everyone into her winning, which I didn't really thought that was kind of stupid. But Missy Hyatt at this time was... My God, yeah.
Yeah, this was the period back before her plastic surgeon played a rib on her. Did too much work or something, I don't know. So,
hey, didn't I? Missy Hyatt will always be 1986 Missy Hyatt to me.
Yeah.
Missy Hyatt will always be wearing those fucking pink and white striped shorts she fucking ran out in Attack Sunshine and walk past.
The days, see, the good old days, the days before sport bras.
Then in the main event, you had Ric Flair pin Vader in 21 minutes to win the WCW World Title. The thing I remember about this show was, wasn't the whole show was Ric Flair and Gene Oakland just trying to get to the building in the limousine?
So did they have the police escort?
I can't remember if it was that. I remember they went to his house and, you know, he had his family there and then they cut back and forth, like the scenes in the limo with them talking about, you know, the match and stuff.
I vaguely remember that, but I mean, I remember the match. Like I say, I remember just Flair punching him in his chin, in his jaw, and Vader saying, "Hit me again," you know, and him chopping the shit out of Vader, and then Vader just pummeling him. I mean, that was awesome.
Remember Vader busting his mouth open, busting Flair's mouth open. It's an awesome match.
Yeah, in some ways, this was the end of an era, too, because I remember I went over and watched it at my friend Rusty's house, because he would get the his family would always get the WCW pay-per-views. I had a buddy, Craig, who went over there. We used to go to his house to watch the WWF ones, but you know, Rusty's dad grew up in the Baltimore area and was, you know, and then you know, a little bit in the South in the service and stuff like that, so he was always a old-school NWA Mid-Atlantic Wrestling fan and, you know, kind of, you know, took real pride in that and was a Georgia fan and because of having TBS. So that was the style of wrestling he liked. And I remember it was, again, that whole lead-up of that whole year and then Flair coming back and winning that match. And it was, you know, huge. And then we get into 1994 where, you know, Bischoff, his influence is in even more and they go and they get Hulk Hogan and all that starts to happen. And that's when, you know, for somebody who's in my age group, and I'm 35, if you're around that age and you're watching at that time and you're a big fan of Crockett, again, even though it was Turner's at that point, that it was the end basically of an era. And it was kind of like, you know, the pinnacle point. It ended with Flair beating Vader, coming back home, and then the next year it wasn't so good for Flair.
This was Starrcade 94. This was the worst Starrcade ever. I'll say that. Worst. This was one of the worst shows ever. I'd rather watch that Match 91 than this bullshit.
If your formative years were then, like if you were watching like USA All-American Wrestling in 93 and you were watching WCW 94 and all that, if that those were your formative years on how you got into wrestling, God bless you, because I was in high school at that time and I had other interests and all this other stuff, but American wrestling was not good unless you were like in Philadelphia.
Yeah. Okay, they had this triple main event. It was Sting against Avalanche. It was Earthquake. Mr. T against
Kevin Sullivan.
Okay. Vader pinned Jim Duggan in the opener to win the United States Championship. I was still pissed off Jim Duggan beat Steve Austin so quickly.
I know, I was pissed off too. That was like, what the fuck? It's like, that's when the darkest day in the history of pro wrestling was fucking watching Hulk Hogan in that goddamn parade. And when Duggan beat Austin, that was just, it wasn't just Hogan, it was, oh my God, he's not doing it himself, he's bringing all his friends and they're gonna all fucking be here. And that's what happened that year.
Alex Wright pinned John Paul Levesque in 14 minutes. This actually may have been the best match on this show.
This was actually good, and it was like, you know, Alex Wright I could never stand, but he was, by that point, for me, it was such high comedy, you know, which he ended up playing off of later on during the Dancing Fools thing. And I just remember Gordon Solie, like, interviewing, you know, John Paul, and then, you know, some of the promos he'd have of how his name is no longer terrorizing. I just did that to get here, and now all of a sudden I went through the best schools, and it was, you know, to see him a lot later on, it's amazing looking back on that, too, when you saw, like, a 215-pound Triple H, and you see
it was amazing seeing him before he got on the fucking steroids.
And he was good. I mean, can't match him. He was actually good. And I don't know how many people ever came out of Killer Kowalski's school or anything like that. I mean, I know the most famous over and over seemed to be Triple H in China, but he at least had a real good base coming out because, I mean, he was good and ended up getting screwed. You know, he was legitimately got lost in the mix because of the people that came in.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he left pretty soon after this to go to the WWF, so.
He sure wasn't no JT Southern, dude. I'll say that, though.
I hope not.
Well, that's... Well, man.
You had WCW TV champion Johnny B. Badd pinned Arn Anderson in 11 minutes. This was probably a decent match, too. Because Johnny B. Badd was pretty good this time, and Arn Anderson. And this was really supposed to be the honky-tonk man. They wanted the Honky Tonk Man to do the job, but he wouldn't until they gave him a contract, so he left.
Yeah, I remember that. He was just there, like, hardly anything. It was like
Jimmy
Jake just came in for, like, a cup of coffee and then took off.
Yeah, and at this time, you know, it was, you know, I like Honky Tonk Man in WWF, but, you know, him being in, a big position in one of these shows is, I don't know, that time had passed for me.
Oh, absolutely, for me too. But that, for no reason at all, that reminds me of, I wonder if Disco Inferno regrets backing out of going to WWF. I think it was in 97 or whenever it was, where he was going to be Honky Tonk Man's protege, I think, against Road Dogg Jesse James. Or the roadie, I guess he was at the time, the singing
roadie. Yeah,
that's
when Disco got fired because he wouldn't do his job to Jacqueline, right?
I remember Jacqueline always beating him like a drum, but I don't remember if he ever got a pinfall or not. He probably did try to refuse it.
Yeah.
But I honestly don't remember. I remember her kicking the shit out of him, though, which was always actually really funny. I always liked Jackie.
He didn't have to worry about the WWE. His big mistake was he never went to Japan, where he could have headlined the Tokyo show against Yuji Nagata or any of the other guys he beat on WCW TV.
I never played as Disco Inferno against Yuji Nagata in the WCW No Mercy game, or whatever it was for them at that time. Whatever it was a really good game, too. I think it was it Thunder? What was that game? For N64.
NWO versus the World or something?
Yeah, maybe that's what it was, a revenge or something like that. He was in there.
Remember that game they had where it was just the only place to fight was backstage with no rings? Backstage Assault?
Yeah, somebody gave me that. That was so hideously bad.
The worst wrestling game was... I believe they had all the WWF guys in, like, monster trucks, and they were just doing, like, demolition derbies or something.
That actually sounds kind of cool, actually.
Anyway, then we go to the Nasty Boys defeated Harlem Heat in 17 minutes by disqualification. This is when they got rid of their slave names of Kane and Cole and went back to Stevie Ray and Booker T.
I never understood that. Like, they were in Global as Booker T and Stevie Ray. They came in as Booker T and Stevie Ray. They changed their names to Kane and Cole and then went back to Booker T and Stevie Ray. Now, the one good thing, because I didn't like these matches, because I actually liked Harlem Heat and I really didn't like the Nasty Boys at this point, they did at some point around here have, like, one of those, it was a bad version of it, but it was a clean WCW-esque, Tupelo concession brawl.
Oh, and Uncensored.
Yeah, that's because I think Tony Schiavone over and over again kept yelling, "It's uncensored. We don't know what they're going to do."
They were like giving each other mustard and ketchup and all kinds of shit like that.
Yeah. Oh, that show had the King of the Road match with the Blacked Out Bully and Dustin Rhodes. That was terrible.
Yeah, it always makes me think of Piper and Goldust, and they're actually using the OJ car chase stuff in there. Yeah, I mean, that they kept going back to that match on the, and it was just ridiculous. Yeah, the Blacktop Bully and Dustin Rhodes.
Then in the next match, you had Mr. Teep and Kevin Sullivan in 3 minutes. I don't even know what this was about. It's 1994, Mr. T. Really?
Yeah, I don't remember this.
Maybe Mr. T had some problems with the IRS or something at that time. You see Mr. T got an infomercial now where it's just like for some pressure cooker or something like that where he's trying to play along with it. It's just like, I'm sure he just made a call and dude needed money. And they look, obviously up and down the card and, you know, the cards around this, it's just, it was all ex-WWF because that's what they did.
Yeah.
With Hogan, you get his people.
This period of WCW was probably the main, like, from not like from when Hogan came in until I'd say like maybe a few months into when Nitro started. This is like some of the most unwatchable TV I've ever seen.
Yep.
It was
terrible. Really was. because it was such a parody.
I'd rather watch Herb Abrams UWF or something like that.
Because you're watching all your favorite fucking news to the Hulk Hogan squad.
Yeah.
And that's what it was. It was more that it's not like those guys even came down. You were used to guys going back and forth and everything. And obviously, most of the time when they went to WWF, if you were a WCW fan, you were like, shit, look how they're using them. But it wasn't that bad. They just beat you over they guzzled the whole show. And it went from being, like I said, all those names of those last pay-per-views of Steamboat and Douglas and Flair and Wyndham and Pillman and all these guys, Austin. And then it was turning into this, which was, again, a bunch of shit you saw when you were a little kid. The people that grew up on Hulkamania were now graduating high school or graduating college or at least in that age bracket, and they weren't trying to see this dumb cartoon, especially as cornball and as shitty as it was.
Yeah, I mean, even in the WWF, at least WWF, it had the kind of production, it made everybody look better, like in the 80s and stuff like that, and then they go to, like, WCW, and everybody's, like, 10 years old and 10 years shittier. So,
I just remember at the time, the first wrestling I ever saw was Georgia. So I pretty much had watched that every day, every Saturday for fucking years. The whole time. And I was always one of the biggest pro NWA, WCW fans, and I watched the WWE, but they were always the enemy. They were always, fuck the WWE. I still watched them, but it was like, fuck the WWE. And I was always fucking told everyone about NWA or WCW. And then, like I said, that fucking parade had to change fucking everything. And then it was like I had to just turn my back on WCW and embrace the WWE. And then from that point on, I was always pro WWE and fuck WCW.
Then we had Sting defeated the Avalanche via DQ. Avalanche was Earthquake.
Before he became the Shark.
That's
became the Shark.
Well, I hate to say, really no recollection of this whatsoever.
Yeah.
I would have lost that bet on you. All right, who'd Sting wrestle? No clue. And would have forgotten really Avalanche was even there, and especially in the semi-main event. But then again, you look at the main event, it's like, damn. And again, as far as the main event goes, the only thing that outdistanced Brutus Beefcake as the Butcher was Brutus Beefcake as the Zodiac. That was it. I longed for the days of the Booty Man with he and Kimberly.
When Hogan and Linda go to court over this whole defamation thing, if she shows the court a tape of this match and said, here's proof they're in a homosexual relationship because there's the only way Bruce Beefcake could be on a pay-per-view main event in 1994. Here's your proof. Dismiss the case.
What the fuck was the Butcher gimmick anyway?
He butchered the friendship, but he turned on him. He was the masked man.
Oh, okay.
At the behest of Kevin Sullivan, maybe? Is that what was going
on
at that time?
Yeah, the three faces of fear. With Kevin Sullivan, the Avalanche, and the Butcher. That's terrible. That makes the Dungeon of Doom look like crap. This is crappier than the Dungeon of Doom,
Yeah.
Terrible.
Well, at least the Dungeon of Doom always had Mangan Barbarian, so you got some cool value out of it.
Yeah,
I was just upset they didn't make Beefcake be like the Baker and the Candlestick Maker after this one.
That's just because they didn't think of it.
Yeah. And
going back to Avalanche, not to talk bad about the dead or anything, but I never, ever liked Avalanche at all. In WWF,
I liked him in
WCW,
with Hogan.
I never liked the dude.
I liked him in the big feud with Hogan in 1990 when he put him out for a while, and then he came back at SummerSlam. They had a big match there, but the only time I liked him.
That was kind of cool just because nobody ever really laid out Hogan, so it was always a big deal. Bundy and Morocco did it, which always pissed me off because Morocco never got any credit in that. They were moving right to Bundy. But, he was a big deal when he actually laid Hogan out, so at least he had credibility right off the bat. And the team with Dino Bravo I actually thought was kind of entertaining.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, it was actually, they teamed up with Dino Bravo, and I can't remember, I think Frenchie Martin was their manager, and Dino was in that wacky, like, really wacky stage where he'd jump around with the blonde hair, extra swollen.
I remember when they brought him in, were they doing the push-up contest with the Warrior? And they picked Big John out of the audience, which was the Earthquake.
Yeah.
Like, Warrior or something like that.
Yeah,
he's a good big man.
The best thing he ever did was when he fucking sat on Damien.
That was awesome.
That was the best thing when he killed Damien and Jake fucking started crying and everything. But other than that, like I said, I never was entertained by him.
The Hulk Hogan versus Penn the Butcher, there's nothing to say about this. This was when Randy Savage came in, and so they were doing the big build-up. Is Savage going to slap Hogan in the face, or are they going to be friends? And I don't know.
What were they? I don't even remember.
You remember when he left WWF and then showed up on WCW Saturday Night?
No, I remember Heenan's debut more than this.
I remember because I watched Raw that week and, like, McMahon did, like, this big thank you to Savage as when he left or something like that.
Damn, I don't remember that at all. I really don't. That's right. It wasn't like no notice, because that's what always said, one of the rumors that always pissed Vince off so much, right?
Yeah. Let's move to Starrcade 95, which was the World Cup of Wrestling. We had the New Japan contingent facing, I guess it was a best of seven series with WCW guys. I actually never saw this show, so I don't have much to say about it. But
I will. It was awesome. I know this is, like, no surprise to anyone, but, yeah, it was awesome. This was the height of how good New Japan was, especially their junior division, and I was lucky enough to see some tapes at that time, and it was, you know, to see Shinjiro Otani wrestle Eddie Guerrero, who was Black Cat over in New Japan, was just awesome, and up and down, this was Sonny Ono, I think it was, brokered a deal with Bobby Heenan. And I forget what kind of chicanery went on Saturday night where they had some sort of wacky agreement between Sonny Ono and Bobby Heenan. And Heenan got Ono into WCW. And then it just, you know, kind of built with him being the face of the Japanese contingent. And, you know, right off the bat, look how Jushin Liger was used in other, you know, star or in other pay-per-views or another Starcade in the past. And then, you know, it opens up with he and Chris Benoit, which was awesome. And it got better from there.
Yeah, it was. I really liked it. To me, I just would have preferred the different results in the matches. But go ahead and start running down the card.
Okay.
You had
Jushin Liger pinned Chris Benoit in 10 minutes and 29 seconds in the opener.
Wait,
and I wasn't able to watch much Japanese wrestling, but I just remember, like, in the magazine and stuff, this was a pretty big feud these guys had for several years. Right?
Oh, yeah, it was, yeah, because they were also teamed over there, too. They did a Junior Four Horsemen, and I can't remember who was in it. It was Benoit, I think he was Wild Pegasus. Yeah, he was still Wild Pegasus at the time over there, and I think he may have already lost the mask, but around that time, it would be him, Liger, El Samurai, and maybe it was Eddie. I can't remember who the other person was, where they actually had, like, a little Junior Horseman thing going on there, and they, you know, put up the four fingers and all that stuff, and it was just, you know, they were rivals and teammates and, you know, going back and forth and for the IWGP title, Junior Heavyweight title, and it was just, again, you could tell they had worked with each other a lot, but it was also, you know, a huge fresh surprise for the most part with everything else, you know, all the other craptastic matches that were taking place at that time and all that, you know, there was so much WWF influence. It was awesome to see, again, because it kind of harkened back to Muda and you know, just awesomeness on WCW pay-per-views. Even though I don't think this did all that well, and of course they blamed it on the Japanese guys, but still.
Yeah, I mean, I remember, you know, I always loved when the Japanese guys came in or they did the super shows. Because the only time I got to see any Japanese wrestling, because at that time, you know, I didn't know about tape trading or any of that stuff. So, but WCW was the only time I got to see any Japanese guys for like 10 years or so when I started watching wrestling.
That's how you're real lucky if you lived anywhere with like a decent Japanese population or, you know, an Asian market.
Of course, I'd always, like in some video stores, they'd have a Japanese tape that are like voiced over by two horrible like American commentators making up their own storylines and bullshit like that. It was kind of weird.
I think Missy Hyatt and Joel Gertner or something, I forget who the two people were, Gertner and somebody, I think, did that for FMW, and they got a couple of pay-per-views in the...
Was it Japanese hardcore wrestling or something like that?
Yeah, I think it was. Although, you know, that's still better. I love the titles like in the wrestling magazines. There would always be for all... I think it was All Japan Women's Wrestling that had two tapes that would always be in, like, PWI and those types of magazines where it was, like, one was called Slant-Eyed Slaughter. Like, Jesus Christ. I'm not even lying to you.
Almighty.
It was, you know, the tagline, these girls kick ass till the rising sun or something. It was just something so incredibly racist. But, you know, then to find out, I could never actually have those tapes anywhere around without, like, you feeling extra bad for being a wrestling fan. And then to find out later on it was all actually, great women's wrestling. That was a little disappointing.
I want to find a picture of that video from that magazine making my new avatar. Slant Eyed Slaughter. In the next match, you had Koji Kanemoto defeated Alex Wright in 11 minutes.
This is, you know, in hindsight, why Kanemoto, and he could have, didn't just kick Alex Wright to death in about a minute and a half. I don't know, but, you know, it is pro wrestling. So, I mean, it was an okay match, although, I mean, Alex Wright was actually... And again, he was not awful or anything like that. He was always, he was missing some things. And just, you know, I could never really buy him. But it wasn't a bad match or anything like that. It did go, you know, kind of long, which, you know, kind of surprised me because I think it was by like, you know, it was late in the match, maybe the 8 minute mark or so. It's just like, okay.
Alex Wright wasn't the greatest wrestler in the world, but. Alex Wright's dad would have taken Kanemoto and had him into a bunch of little knots and made him his bitch.
You know, at that point with Kanemoto, maybe, because his dad actually was, apparently was really, really, really good. But I don't know, was Steve Wright from, like, the Snake Pit or anything like that?
I don't know. I've only seen him wrestle two matches. One of them was with Tiger Mask, and... honestly, I enjoyed that better than some of his Dynamite Kid matches. I just remember there were two different points in the match where they got so tangled up that the referee had to kind of stop them, and they stopped and they shook hands, and then the referee untangled their legs and arms because they were literally in a knot and they couldn't move.
Unreal.
I think Alex Wright was at his best, like, in the next couple of years. Remember when he had that run with the Cruiserweight title against Jericho and then won the TV title against Ultimo Dragon?
No, his best thing was with the fucking Disco Dudes. When him and Disco were the dancing fools, that was the greatest fucking thing. Them and Chavo and Pepe were my two favorite things on WCW at the time.
Oh, God. I hated Chavo and Pepe, but I got to admit, Disco Alex Wright at Tokyo Magnum, you know, when he came in as, you know, when Ultimo Dragon's guys came in, and he was, again, he was a perfect, you know, jackass suck-up roadie for them, too, which I actually thought was great because, yeah, Alex Wright doing the dance and then, like, kind of waving it off, and Kid Romeo did that same thing later on during the death of the last few weeks of WCW, too, where it was just... You know, him playing the character himself was better than him being Alex Wright.
Remember when he shaved his head and became Berlin?
You know, I wanted to actually buy that for the lead up to it, and then that woman, it went on for so long, and that woman butchered so much that night. I thought that took everything away from it, and then it was just like pale bald Alex Wright in a feud with like the Misfits and stuff like that so fast it wasn't even funny.
Only thing that came out of that was the wall, I guess.
Yeah, because, again, that was, like, one of those big dudes where it was, like, you know, I don't know how long he'll be able to pull off wrestling in the suit, you know, Mr. Hughes style or anything like that. But, you know, at least it was a big, fresh dude.
I just remember that one thing with the wall that was just so fucking awesome. It was, like, one of the best things on TV, and it's probably like his only real highlight, dude.
Well, when he's standing up on top of the hotel and Hogan screams, "That's the wall, brother."
Yeah, dude, that was awesome. But that's like the only
binoculars wouldn't have been able to see him. Jesus.
Well, it's Hulk Hogan, brother. He's got special powers, dude. He's not an ordinary man.
It's that type of ridiculous stuff that every once in a while, I know it's so over the top, and I know I shouldn't like it, but every once in a while, that stuff catches me with such a, like, yeah, it was better than, like, Andre, what was it, the Big Show, the giant Hulk Hogan, the monster trucks on top of the Cobo Arena, and then he came back in with, like, seaweed on him because he fell in Lake Michigan. Like, sometimes stuff like that is just, you know.
Walsh should just, he should have been standing on the moon. I mean, it's been same effect. Yeah. The next match we had Lex Luger beat Macho by submission in 6 minutes.
This kind of surprised me a little bit because I thought, because obviously it was best of seven, that it was like, okay, they're going to get out to a 3-0 lead. But no, it was, you know, it didn't, you know, no surprise or anything like that. I wasn't the biggest Luger fan in the world, especially at that time, with Jimmy Hart bouncing around. And, you know, again, I liked Chono, and I was familiar with him. But it was, you know, again, a short match that really nothing happened in, and Luger got the win. It was like, okay, I'm the next one.
This is like, to me, as great as this show was, it'll never be like in that really top echelon for me because I just hated the outcomes of some of the matches. And this is another one. It's like, God damn it, I wish Chono would have won this one.
And it was in the wrong place. And I mean, in a way, it was good because there was heat for the anti-Japanese thing. But again, I mean, and again, they booked it way in advance. But I don't. Nashville. To do this type of show, I mean, in Philadelphia, Baltimore, a million one other places. Again, it's not like it's their fault or whatever. I don't know when the deal was made with New Japan to do this, and when they had booked. I'm sure they had it, you know, 5-6 months in advance on the municipal auditorium. But it's like that. I don't think really helped matters either. It's not like they maximized it with where they were at because it was just like a lot of people that didn't have any time for. You know, matches like Liger and Benoit, and it's not like the crowd was off or anything, but it's just like the appreciation wasn't there.
It reminded me of like the Heavenly Bodies against Rock and Roll Express in Boston at that Survivor Series.
Yeah.
You know, just the teams, these two teams from the South that most in Boston probably never even, I mean, don't even know that they're in a program or where they're even wrestling or anything like that. They're just thrown out there in the middle of a pay-per-view and didn't get any reaction at all.
You know, at that time for the rock and roll, it's like, who are these skinny old necks? I mean, that's what that crowd was thinking. You know, whether anybody likes it or not, at least that crowd, that's what they were thinking. And in a way, you can't blame them, because how the hell would they know?
Then you had Johnny B. Badd defeated Masa Saito by disqualification in about 5 minutes.
Yeah, this was just, I like Mr. Saito and Johnny B. Badd and Kimberly. You know, it didn't expect Saito to win. Yeah, sure, it would have been nice, but yeah, you knew it wasn't going to happen. But, you know, it was a shitty way to end things, too.
This is the Saito that was basically on steroids and was like the Japanese Steiner version. But do you guys remember the somewhat fat Mr. Saito with the ugly black sock?
Yeah. Yes. The Mr. Fuji, Mr. Saito, Aero Saito?
Yeah, and he wore a fucking black sock on one foot. I never understood that. It was like, and it wasn't even like a fucking, like a mountain climbing sock. It was like a dress sock.
Was that the awesome, like, I think it was like the big WWF title change. You had Rick Martel and Tony Garea, and like, I think Martel for body press and caught a face full of salt or something. It was like on one of those first. Best of
oh, yeah.
WWF tape
yeah.
That I ever
saw. I saw it on TV.
Yeah.
I remember when it happened.
I was with the poof of, you know, the salt is still, like, you know, in the air and all over the place if they got the pin. But, you know, that is wrestling.
And then I also remember when he was the unknown soldier and won the AWA title from Larry Zbyszko.
Yeah, that was actually like the last time something of note happened in the AWA. And don't say the turkey pole match. I'm talking like...
Dude, I'm gonna find all the fucking video footage of that Team Challenge Series, get it on DVD, and we're going to do a show on the fucking AWA Team Challenge Series, dude.
I mean, I had to watch
You could do a show alone on the airbrushed backdrop in the studio that they'd use at that time.
Did you ever say when they did the Team Challenge Series and they did this in the, like, empty studio?
Oh,
with
yeah.
Cardboard cutouts of fans?
I'm taking you to Larry Land, Spudhead.
Oh, gosh. That was terrible.
Yeah, it was...
Dude,
yeah,
we're going to do this. Someone needs to make us a comp of this fucking Team Challenge Series, dude.
I think Saeed needs to go for the belt.
Then we had where were we? Shinjiro Otani pinned Eddie Guerrero in 13 minutes.
This was an awesome match, and this one I actually didn't mind Otani winning, but this is a match where, you know, I wanted Eddie to win this one.
Otani was so awesome. You know, so underratedly awesome. He didn't look like much too. If you were just to look at him, but that face wash, he was, you know, he's still good now, you know, and just however old he is at this point. But back then, it was a little crew with him, Koji Kanemoto is the young guy, and Takaiwa was the other guy with him. And Otani was just crazy good at this time. And him and Guerrero had worked together a bunch. And again, just awesome. It's like when Dean Malenko first came in, you know, for me when I saw Otani, where it was just like they are unassuming looking guys that can pretty much do everything, and they hit hard. Everything looks good. It looks realistic. And he and Guerrero had it was an awesome match.
He was the first cruiserweight champion in WCW, I believe, Otani was.
Yeah, he was. He beat Benoit in Japan, and it was, you know, in the end of a tournament finals, that was an awesome, awesome match. And then I think he came over here, and I think he may have lost it to Benoit. I can't remember if he lost it to Benoit.
He lost
that
it to Malenko in, like, his first match, I think, as champion over here.
Was it Malenko?
Yeah.
Okay, because
I remember, I think he won the tournament final before the tournament in the United States had even ended.
That... Back in the age where era was changing as far as the word getting out.
Yeah. Then you had WCW champion Randy Savage pin Hiroshi Tenzan in 6 minutes.
Okay, now in this match, how long was it again? 6 minutes?
About six minutes and 55 seconds.
Okay, well then, like, Tenzan win, like, 6 minutes and 30 seconds of the match, and then Savage just won at the very end with the elbow.
I don't remember.
Pretty much.
And this is another match where I was pissed off because I was like, I wanted Tenzan to win.
And they pretty much just slammed into each other and everything, yeah, and it was just like, it was just kind of over quick, and it was... Again, you know, Savage won, which wasn't a big surprise or anything like that, but it was just like, huh? You know, it just he did get it, like, it was late at the last minute or whatever, 2 minutes of the match, and it was just, that was it, and it was over. It was like, okay. It went a hell of a lot shorter than I thought it would.
I didn't even know why Savage was even in this World Cup.
Well, Team WCW, like him and Luger and who else, they were kind of all buddy-buddy at the time.
Well, because you know, he was supposed to defend the title later on, so it kind of seems silly for him to be in this.
No clue. Maybe you need to tell if the Dave Meltzer bat signal.
Then in the final match, Sting defeated Kensuke Sasaki in 6 minutes and 52 seconds to win the World Cup of Wrestling 4-3.
No surprise here, and again, it went way too short, and it was really disappointing because it's like you knew both guys could go, and it was just like, eh.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, they should have just had, the whole show should have just been the tournament, or the best of thing. They should have took everything else out, they should have just let them all have longer matches, because they could have had a good 15, 20 minute match. and made it better. But unfortunately, they had to put a bunch of other stuff on there. But it was pretty good. And speaking of Kasaki, I just watched I just posted on Facebook yesterday the clip of him and Kobayashi where they just for like 5 minutes chopped the living shit out of each other for like 5 minutes straight. They hit each other like 100 chops and just like that was fucking awesome.
I remember this was not the last one they would see of Sasaki tonight because it was so weird. After the show went off the air, they came back and one man gang beat Sasaki for the United States Championship in a dark match after the show ended. I didn't understand that.
Yeah, that was weird.
Well, because that was just, it was a political thing with New Japan. Because it was, Kensuke, they filmed it where it was, Kensuke got the win. And, they made a big deal. They showed it for Japanese purposes with him winning the title. And then they restart the match, Gang wins.
Oh, yeah.
They never even mentioned it. And it was like this blip. And then I think it was they did the same thing. Or they had, I think they did the same thing after that because it was Conan who ended up beating Gang, I think, after that. And it was another one of those wacky type things that had happened where it was just like, okay. Again, not being, very savvy at the time of knowing what was going on, you still saw the... it was only like inside wrestling and the roll call of champions or whatever it was later on. It was just like, huh, okay, this didn't make any sense. When they talked about it of, how he was still claiming to be champion over there. And they had done it with, they did it earlier too with Fujinami and Flair for the couple of years earlier than that where they had the split champions thing too.
Yeah, I think maybe this was the last Sasaki was going to be in the country for a while, so they needed to get the belt off him. And it's maybe their only time to do it, so.
Yeah, the one
and he gave, and there was a push at Kensuke at the time, too. I mean, a big one, because things were starting to change there, too. And there was this, push of new talent, and he was one of them, and he was, a star. And, he's kind of graduated from the tag ranks. It was him and Hiroshi Hase, and he would team with, Road Warrior Hawk over there, too. And this was kind of, he was rolling along at a singles ascension, and that, back when titles and things like this actually meant something.
And he had an awesome mullet.
He did, and he was all man, too, because you have to be to go to bed every night with Akira Hokuto.
I wonder who was the top and who was the bottom in that relationship.
That.
Okay, in the next match, had Ric Flair defeated Lex Luger and Sting and 28 minutes by count out in a triangle match, and that put Ric Flair advanced to the next match, and where he pinned Randy Savage in 8 minutes to win the WCW World Title.
Well, that explains why Savage. And I don't remember this at all. It was probably a situation leading up to this where, Flair probably beat somebody up who was supposed to be in this World Cup of Wrestling. He had to wrestle twice, so damn it, Savage is going to have to wrestle twice because it's not fair. But I can't remember,
remember Ric Flair did like one of the worst blade jobs of all time. Or best or worst, depending on what you think blade job is,
Well, I mean, that's kind of hard to kind of visualize because I saw Ric Flair covered from head to toe in blood for like 20 years, so it's kind of like kind of hard to put one above another one.
Yeah.
It was amazing. He loved to bleed. And I don't know how many aspirin he ever took in his life, leading into this, too. I wonder if he was just doing shots of vodka and just like downing aspirin to make it that thin where it would always fly up in his hair like that.
I like when he smacked his own forehead in promos and made himself start bleeding. It's like the Sandman smashing a can on his head.
Yeah.
next year you had Starrcade 1996, which I guess up to this point was maybe one of the biggest shows they ever had because this was, when they were getting really hot at that point and had Hogan and Piper in the main event. This was, again, from Nashville, Tennessee. In December 29th, 1996. And I guess this was a dark match. You had Masquerita Sagrada and Octagoncito beat Jarrito Estrada and Purita Morgan. I'm surprised I said all that right.
I don't remember
that. I'm said that right.
Send that in and let Granny say all
those guys were awesome. Sagata and Apicanchito, they were fucking awesome. They were like pound for pound the best wrestlers in the world at that time.
Yeah, they were kind of short.
They were awesome. They were only like 2 inches shorter than fucking Chris Benoit and Shawn Michaels.
No.
Okay, Darius Estrada was only a couple inches shorter than Chris Benoit.
Yeah, I don't, why? That's kind of, it's so random. I don't even remember them being around at that time.
Especially considering not long after they were working with WWE.
That's right. Is that when Super Astros was born?
Yeah, around that time. That's when they had like the Royal Rumble here in San Antonio, when they had like the whole like pretty much like a cold card.
Anyway, in the first match, you had the J Crown champion Ultimo Dragon pinned Dean Malenko to win the WCW Cruiserweight title in 18 minutes. I haven't seen the show either. So
that's an awesome, awesome match, and the pose at the end of it. Even him coming into the ring with Sonny Ono behind him, Ultimo Dragon had all of the J Crown titles wrapped around him, and him with a shit-eating grin on his face after the match, holding up that title too, was just absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, that was an awesome match. Dragon was awesome.
For those who don't know, too, the J Crown was a lot of titles and groups that they were working with in Mexico and everything, and the WWF light heavyweight title was still actually technically used at that time. Mikanoshu Pro, I think, had basically usurped use of that title at that time away from Mexico, and they were using it as well. And not long after this, you know, they went back to having a light heavyweight division, or at least an attempted one in 97. So they ended up, you know, stripping it out of there. And it's not like they ever made reference to it on WCW or anything like that, but it was, you know, a bunch of titles from a bunch of different wrestling promotions, all working in Japan and having close relationships with New Japan. And then, you know, Ultimo Dragon had won the title. In fact, in the lead up to the J Cup, as the Japanese tape is called, Lance Storm actually wrestles on that show with Mochizuki in the first match. And that was the first time I'd ever seen anyone drop down between a guy's legs and roll them up in a double Boston Crab. Now, I know he always did the single leg one later on, but it was actually really awesome to see him use a double, roll right into it. It was amazing. And, you know, he's one of the ones at the end of the match that throws his war tag team title into the middle of the ring to signify that the J Crown tournament was going to take place. And Ultimo Dragon ended up winning it. And him coming over and beating Malenko was just that visual. One, the match was good, and it was a hell of a way for me to start a pay-per-view. But him, the visual of him with all of those titles was just so over the top great.
Next match, you had Akira Hokuto pinned Medusa in 7 minutes to become the first WCW women's champion.
Americans will just never love women's wrestling. At least
what?
Women's wrestling. Well, at least stiff women's wrestling, because, you know, outside of a little bit of a time, you know, they just, one, the crowd deserved better on that match, but really, you know, that giving them only 7 minutes, and, you know, they beat the shit out of each other, and people, it didn't click with the people watching, and that was pretty obvious watching it, you know, at home, too, and too bad, too, because Hokuto kicked so much ass.
Yeah, it was an awesome match, but as long as there's fucking pussy and ass and tits in the match, I'm a fan, so at least there's one person who fucking cares, whether they're fucking dancing around like Kelly or beating the shit out of each other like Akira Hokuto or Bull Nakano. But, yeah, it was a good match, and, like I said, Hokuto was one scary woman. I mean, I can actually see her being the top of that relationship. And
so if China was in the ring, you would be all for this?
Well, before I knew she had a fucking little penis, yeah.
Oh, Christ. Okay, next match. Jushin Liger pinned Rey Mysterio Jr. in 14 minutes. And I don't remember, was this like the first ever time they wrestled, or they wrestled before?
No, they had wrestled before in New Japan before this, but yeah, you know, they did a lot of the same stuff too. Where it was like, you know, Mysterio up, if I recall correctly, like Mysterio up on his shoulders and then you know, kind of facing the other way from him. Or trying to think of how. Or, oh no, he did the spin moonsault or Frankensteiner where he was on top of his shoulders and then spun around and, you know, Frankenstein him through with a cradle. And, you know, there were moves like that. And, again, they just Mysterio, when he came in and wrestled against Malenko his first match, and I think that, I guess that was Baltimore at the Bash, and I was there for that. It was just like, he was so small and he was so awesome where, you know, average, you know, the smallest, you know, wrestling fan liked him because of, he was just like a little superhero, and him and Liger were like two superheroes meeting in that match, and it was really, again, really, really good. I'm biased because I liked both of those guys a lot, but it was just, this is when WCW was really awesome because it was when you got your Baskin-Robbins 31 flavors on a show. They gave you a little bit of everything, and what they gave you in those little doses for the most part was pretty awesome and made up for the fact that there were so many stiffs in the main events.
This was Jushin Liger. He'd just come back from like a brain tumor, hadn't he, at this point?
I'm trying to think, yeah, because it may have been that year's Best of the Super Juniors where he had a concussion and was out, and I think it may have been around that time. It was around this time, but I'm not sure exactly when it was.
Yeah, I remember that.
And I just remember that match was awesome. I mean, I was I just haven't seen him too much lately, but I was one of the biggest Jushin Liger fans when he was coming in and they were going over there. I mean, he was fucking awesome.
Next match,
Bruce Mitchell always said it was like people aren't cheering for the guy, they're cheering for a suit, and that's not true because if you don't have charisma, it can actually show through the mask. I mean, it really can, and your emotions and everything else. And I mean, always thought that was really underselling Liger a lot.
Liger, he was an awesome babyface, and he could be a fucking dick. Like, and I'll never forget that one match from the first J Cup where it's him and Sasuke. Yeah, and the Great Sasuke fucking fucks up and crashes and burns, and Liger fucking totally saved the matches and made it even better the way it ended when he fucking just was like fucking threw his hand in the air like telling everyone, yeah, look at this fucking goof, and then he fucking gets
in. He's clapping after he makes that big spiel. He just thumbs up.
In the next match, you had Jeff Jarrett pin Chris Benoit in 13 minutes. I guess this was when the whole Nancy and Kevin Sullivan thing was going down, right?
Yep.
Which, if that would never happen, wrestling history would be a lot different.
Right.
Something to think about shit like that.
Well, this was Jared, and, you know, Jared would go in, and he was in and out of there at that time. This was, you know, the whole Horseman thing was going on, and Jared Benoit would get into it, and, you know, yeah, this, that, and the other. And it was just, you know, I guess he was gone not long after this because, you know, Anderson basically booted him out. But, yeah, the Benoit-Nancy thing was going on, and it was at the Bash that year, you know, the legendary Bash where – there's a lady in a man's bathroom, and, you know, they had the brawl, and that Bash in 96 was awesome when the Outsiders put Bischoff through the table and everything.
There's a lady! There's a lady in the man's bathroom! Look at that! There is a woman in the man's gun right here in Baltimore!
Him getting kicked down the steps. I mean, just... That was a hot crowd. They actually hammered at that show in a large, oversized, novelty green Macho Man Randy Savage hat.
Hammered. It was the only time I could buy, like, Kevin Sullivan as a wrestler. You know, when he's going up against guys like Benoit or somebody.
Him and Benoit, that match, they really looked like they were trying to beat the shit out of each other in that match.
And the thing was, too, I liked Jeff Jarrett, and I know people hate him, and I know, you know, especially at that time, they just, the Memphis thing and everything, but I don't know, I liked Jarrett even though, you know, I liked Benoit more, but it was still like, you know, not long after this, or, you know, it was getting towards, I guess, the Bash of next year, by that time, Jarrett was gone.
He would have good matches, but he was always more entertaining as a character than as a wrestler. And when he beat up those little kids in the dojo, that was like one of the greatest things I ever saw.
Did you watch the thing last night?
I haven't seen that part, but I went back and watched it. It reminded me of him and the kids. I went back and watched him beating the shit out of the little kids.
Yeah, I just listened to Brian and Vinny last night, and they were talking about how awesome it was. I'm trying to see if I can find it somewhere. Anyway, the next match, WCW Tag Team Champion Scott Hall and Kevin Nash defeated Ming and the Barbarian. Ming and the Barbarian were one of my favorite teams at this point.
I wish they just let a shot on them and kick their ass. It would have been awesome.
Yeah, really. And that's what I was thinking, too, watching it, because it was like, you know, the outsiders were cool and all that, but you knew what the result was going to be. And again, for, you know, for me, too, I like making the Barbarians. I was like, all right, this is kind of going to suck. And it just, you know, it was, there was a lot of, you know, it went 12 minutes. I would have said it went 5, because I remember there was a lot of stalling and posturing and all that other stuff. And it, you know, seeing the Ming and the Barbarian getting beat up by Kevin Nash and Scott Hall, it was just, you know, you knew it had to happen. It wasn't awful or anything like that, but it was a relatively forgettable match. And the fact that Jimmy Hart was still, like, hanging on with the Faces of Fear was, you know, even worse.
The next match, you had the finals of the U.S. Heavyweight title tournament. You had Eddie Guerrero pin Diamond Dallas Page in 15 minutes. And this is where I think the NWO attacked DDP to kind of knock some sense into him, because they wanted him to join the NWO or something. So they cost him the match.
This is when DDP was getting over big time.
Yeah.
Or starting to.
You know, one thing about DDP, if he, I don't know how much he would have gotten
this
over.
This is when he was getting really, really good as a wrestler. Compared to like the
if
fucking.
If he didn't have the diamond cutter, I don't know how big he would have gotten over, though. That was a hot
move
at the time. I
mean, the diamond cutter was a great
move. Randy Orton, and what do you got? You know?
Yeah, I mean, he had a great move. It just, the thing that drove me nuts was not long before this, it was like, and I think it was DDP and Eddie, where Eddie kept beating him, and it's like, you know, the DDP lost the Diamond Dolls, he was going to live in his car, it was like he was going to hock the ring, you know, I think they sent him, I think it was at PWI, where he was going to be intern for a day, you know, because, it, you know, they really, WWF was not working with any of those after magazines or anyone else at the time. That's one of the reasons Dean Malenko ended up number one, I think it was in the 97 PWI 500. But it was, you know, it was not long before this. It was like DDP as, like, white trash guy now being broke white trash guy. And then it was, you know, then he started to ascend. And it was, again, not to say he didn't work hard and everything in hindsight. It was like, you know, okay, cool. But it was, you know, put me in that camp of how it was so blatantly disingenuous. And it was like, it just amazed me. And it also, but he was one of those guys for that older WCW crowd. They seemed to take to him for some reason. The fact he was always out there in a heroic role always helped.
Yeah. next, we had Lex Luger pin the Giant in 13 minutes, and I think this might have been the first time in like 6 months the NWO got beat.
Yeah, it was like they had to beat one of them, and it was, you know, again,
yeah, it was the biggest, baddest one they had. That was so stupid.
But, yeah, it was Lex Luger. Man, they always had, remember Lex Luger beat Hogan? You know, and I think it was a decision they made relatively, you know, like, incredible short notice. I mean, they always, Luger was always going to be the face of WCW. And,
yeah.
You know, again, he goes out there and beats the Giant. I don't think the match was awful or anything like that, but it was just like, no, Luger.
I think Sting interfered or something like that, because, you know, that's when they started doing the whole Crow gimmick. And started building him up for, like, the next year or so.
Yeah, and somebody else had interfered for, you know, it was with that thing back and forth, where, like, the NWO came out and tried to do their attacks, and then, you know, at the end, it was just like, you know, they made you forget about the fact that Sting was going to rappel in.
Yeah.
or at that time, it wasn't rappelling, but it was going that direction.
It was, you had Roddy Piper beat Hulk Hogan in 15 minutes with a sleeper hold. Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't, you know.
It felt huge at the time, you know, Roddy Piper and Hulk Hogan. But, I don't know.
It didn't feel huge to me.
I know I'm in the minority, I guess, of people at that time because, you know, people actually wanted to see Hogan and Piper. I didn't.
Yeah.
It was, remember the outsiders, like, you know, grabbing Piper and, like, pulling up his kilt and showing, like, the surgery scar of, like, you know, and they Hogan was beating on that, and I think that, you know, Piper's son was out there or something like that, and he smacked him around a little bit, and it was just, again, Piper's mouth was fine, you know, as far as, like, cutting promos and stuff like that, but even then, it was more than a little tired for me, and more than a little tired to be in a Starrcade main event, you know.
And this
again,
is
this
people-
is... This was a decade and a half after WrestleMania.
This is when the fans thought he had won the world title, even though it was for a non-title match, but nobody ever said so. Go back and read the WCW.
Do any of you guys remember this? Okay, when Piper went to WWE, did he ever, like, take a break from WWF and come back to, NWA for, like, a short time and then go back to WWF? Because I kind of have this memory of seeing this fucking promo on fucking Saturday night where it's kind of, like, in the woods and it's kind of, like, I almost want to say it was black and white, but I'm not sure if it was black and white, but you're just the camera's panning through the woods and then you see, like, a pair of shoes or boots. And it's like someone's being hung, and they slowly scam up the body so you get to the face, and it's fucking Piper just like with a noose around his neck, just like laughing and shit.
We'll have to ask Craig next week. He should know. But
what year
was
that?
You know, they never said this was a title match or a non-title match. They just kind of left it out there. But
he beat him twice, too, didn't he?
He did what?
He beat him twice, too, didn't he? Did Piper beat Hogan two straight?
He remembered that at Super Bowl the next year they came back and they did, like, the dusty finish where he put him out with the sleeper and then Savage pulled Hogan's legs under the ropes or something like that.
Ah, okay, that's what it was, okay.
And he also broke a beer bottle over his head, like a bottle over his head while he was being hung.
Well, I remember that with
the
sheep herders. I remember that with the sheep herders in Portland, where it was him and Martel against the sheep herders, and he hit himself in the head.
Oh, this is just a skit where he's in the woods, and he's being, for some reason, looks like he's being hung, and he's like, he smashes a bottle over his head.
That
was a face, actually. He came back as a face, as I remember.
That's back when he and Rick Martel were Strike Force. That's what Craig would say.
That sounds like some shit Piper would have done with Bud Sawyer before
Craig would have said that's back when him and Rick Martel beat Mr. Saito and Mr. Fuji for the WWE Tag Team Champions.
No, he wouldn't actually remember Mr. Saito. Would he? No, no way. You put somebody else in there.
Then we go to the next year, Starrcade 1997, which I'm thinking this is probably the biggest buy rate that they ever did. 1.9 by right.
It's up there. It probably, you know what? I think it is. Because, yeah, they had better TV ratings and stuff like that, but this is actually the pinnacle of it. And I was there, and it sucked.
This was
terrible. It sucked. I think they had the WCW guys, like, at ringside, like, in seats, where fans would be. And I can't remember.
Like
it was
with
Nitro,
the common people.
Yeah. And it was, you know, at the end of it, when Sting won, they all celebrated. And it was like, and I can't remember if Johnny B. Badd and or Mark Mero and Sable were shown in the audience then or if it was at Raw. I'm trying to think of what were not at Raw, at Nitro. But I think they may have been there at the time. And it was like they showed them on camera, but they couldn't mention them. It's like, oh, we know who that is. And it
was
just
like... I think it was a few years later.
Was it a couple of years later? Because that was in D.C., too. I remember it was either there or in Baltimore for the arena for that, too. But, yeah, I guess it would have been. He was still beating up Sable in WWE this time, I guess. But it wasn't good. I mean, it just wasn't good. I don't know. A lot of the stuff leading up to this wasn't any good either. The crowd wasn't really feeling it. Again, it just Eddie and DeMolenko started off, and that was awesome. And then it just went downhill from there because it was a lot of nonsense. Although, you you know, Goldberg later on, and to see him actually blow up a year later boggled my mind, because it was like, this is the same guy that got knocked out by Steve McMichael with a lead pipe, you know, and Steve McMichael stole his Super Bowl ring, Bill Goldberg stole his Super Bowl ring, then got it back that way, because that's what they were feuding over at the time, Goldberg being an ex-Falcon and Steve McMichael being a Bear.
The first match here was Cruiserweight Champion Eddie Guerrero pinned Dean Malenko, and you know, for these two guys, I remember this match, and this match was not very good that I remember, or nothing stood out about this match. I'd say, I wouldn't say the work was very good, just nothing memorable.
No, I think there were some slip-ups, and it was good, and it was, you know, I would say it was the best match on the show, because actually Henny and DDP, if I remember right, was actually pretty damn good. And was it Raven Saturn? I'm trying to think of that match. The Saturn match was good too. But it was okay, but they had so many awesome ones where, yeah, it wasn't spectacular or anything like that, but it was still a good way to start the pay-per-view.
Guys were having such great matches for so many weeks on TV, let alone pay-per-view, that it's just hard for anything really to stand out at that point.
And another thing is, you know, I think this was at the time, this was like, Malenko's wife was like maybe within days of giving birth to their first child, and he was wanting to be there for that, but he had the, even though they had Rey Mysterio there, they could easily slide into the match, so. Maybe he was a little bit off thinking about that or something. I don't know. That was just one of the stories going around at the time. He had Randy Savage and Scott Norton and Vincent beat Ray Taylor and Rick and Scott Steiner when Savage pinned Scott Steiner. This was originally supposed to be Conan, but I think his wife had a miscarriage or something, or a stillborn child or something, like a few days before. So obviously he wasn't there. And so Savage came in, and Savage only agreed to do the match if he could get the pinfall.
Again, I don't really remember this other than Miss Elizabeth, when she came back, was hot. Not that she wasn't beautiful, it was like she was beautiful and pretty before. I don't know, she just came back looking hot.
She was porno hot when she came back. Or she was just, you could never see Miss Elizabeth in some positions, but she came back porno hot.
Well, that's, yeah, she came out, yeah, like MILF 90s hot, you know, that, yeah, just looking good. Enough of that. What didn't look good was Steve McMichael and Bill Goldberg, or Deborah McMichael's voice at this time.
I think she's already gone by this point.
Was she? Was she in WWF with Jarrett, or yes?
Well, no,
is that
she
who she went up there with
she
at first?
I mean, it's been like a year later, but, I mean, she spent like a year or so, like, just, she just out of the business until Jeff Jarrett showed up, like until 1998 or something like that, late 98 with Jeff Jarrett. So,
here was the woman wanted to punch her right in the face.
I was on mute. When was the last time you guys heard me?
Say that again.
I said I just realized I was on mute on my phone. When was the last time you guys heard me?
I don't pay attention when you're talking.
I don't think it was for too long at all.
Well, I got distracted getting texts from Stevie. I think we're having technical difficulties on Blog Talk right now. But anyway.
Yeah, Bill Goldberg and Steve McMichael in 5 minutes. Nothing right on.
Yeah,
about
what it was.
I hated Steve McMichael. He's probably the most hated wrestler ever. I mean, and as far as, and that, not even in the good heat sense, I mean, if there was ever just one person who I could just remove from the history of pro wrestling, it would be Steve McMichael.
He's kind of right up there. He was a shitty announcer with, you know, holding the dog, you know, on Nitro.
Dog. I love animals, but I wanted to fucking stomp on that dog to death.
Was it in start is, Great American Bash 96, that was the only time I actually liked him, when it was, you know, they were reforming the Horsemen, And that was the other thing about that match that people forget about with Sullivan was after that match, the Horsemen were reformed because Arn got in the ring. And I remember, you know, we all talked to Doug Dillinger earlier on that, you know, in the show, it's just like, all right, the Horsemen reforming. He just had that, you know, just smiled and said, stay tuned. So it was like, okay, obviously they were doing it. And then it was awesome because it was Woman and Elizabeth and Flair Anderson and Benoit. And then it was just, you know, how that match ended. It was Bobby Heenan coming back to be Flair and Anderson's manager. And again, I know we're talking about the past year, but like kind of the lead up all into that was actually really awesome. And it was the only time when he took the briefcase and slammed it over his head. That was actually really awesome. And then like instantly, as soon as they all cut a promo together, it was like, okay, I hate you, Steve McMichael.
And that was actually a decent match with McMichael and Kevin Green.
It really, really was, and obviously those two actually, they did bust their ass to be able to do that, and they did work really hard.
I thought Kevin Green was pretty good as a professional wrestler.
He wasn't bad for, you know, he only had a couple matches, but again, he, you know, the one match where he really looked good, he was against Arn Anderson and Ric Flair.
Yeah.
He was way better than fucking Steve McMichael. Oh my God, it wasn't even close.
The next match had Saturn defeated Chris Benoit in 10 minutes via submission, no DQ match. This was supposed to be Raven. Raven had an appendicitis. They had so many no-shows on this thing. We skipped over. The Giant was supposed to wrestle Kevin Nash. And Kevin Nash didn't show up. He apparently had heartburn or something. He couldn't make it. And he thought he was having a heart attack, but he had heartburn. So they just sent Scott Hall out there to do a promo, and then the Giant came out there and chokeslammed him or something. That was it. And then Raven beforehand Raven wasn't going to be in this match. They still, you know, promoted him for it. They had the six man where Randy Savage had to take Conan's place. And I don't know, this whole show is just littered with bullshit.
The whole company was at the time. I mean, the issues, you know, obviously the contract issues and Nash being able to do things like that and people with, you know, obviously drug and alcohol issues and all that other stuff. And at least with Raven, it was an angle they were doing at the time where he would get into it with somebody and he'd do his douche routine of, I don't want this. I'm getting, you know, put down about what about me? Screw this sick boy. You take care of him. And somebody else would jump in. And obviously
yeah.
Saturn... And they played off this later on with Saturn, you know, stopped getting pushed by him. But, you know, Sick Boy and Lodi and Kidman and Scotty Riggs for a little while, you know, after he got his eye busted out in the chair or whatever it was, and then he became our Pirate Stevie, you know, Scotty Riggs. You know, they would do Raven's bidding for him. So at least there was, you know, a plausible reason for this. And, again, they went – it was unfortunate how the Raven-Saturn – the Flock and the Horsemen at that time and in the next couple of years, it was like they were intertwined together, sad, obviously, with the Radicals and everything. They were always intertwined together, but it was, talk about not getting your due, because this, you know, this match actually should have been a lot better and received a lot better, too.
And I was pissed off because I was a big Raven fan at the time and I never seen him and go up against a guy like Chris Benoit, who I loved at that point. So I was kind of pissed off. They didn't have the match.
And it was only around this time where I really was, like, into ECW. I think it was, like, late 96. Because it just wasn't my style. But, you know, in not paying much attention to it, you know, in 93, 94, 95, what I missed out on were, you know, matches like Raven and Benoit and Mysterio and Jericho and all those guys. So, you know, seeing them all in WCW but not... You know, in a way, you know, we caught the tail end of them in ECW, like the Eliminators and Raven and stuff like that. I was like, this is going to be awesome. And it was, you know, it wasn't to the level of like Shane Douglas going to become Dean Douglas and failing so miserably and going back. But it was kind of, it was just disappointing because it was like, you know, you knew these dudes were better than what they were being served.
Yeah.
Hold on. What are you guys talking about? I got distracted. I'm looking at basically a picture of Lily Valentine's pussy on Facebook.
Who? Nothing wrong with that.
I'm finding this distress that you're looking at porno while you're talking to us.
Well, there's a fucking pussy lip ring sticking out of her thong, dude.
I don't care.
It's very distracting to me. I'm sorry. Don't worry. I'm turning the page. I'm turning.
Okay. I'll go to the next match. The next match was Buff Bagwell, Ken Lex Luger. This was no good.
No, it was not.
Yeah, I can't imagine how this could be anything close to being even acceptable, almost.
Maybe if it was Lex Luger from, like, 1989, it would have been a little bit better.
Yeah.
That's about it.
Yeah, at this point, these guys were just going through the motions. I mean, Buff had already gotten so much jacked up, he really wasn't doing much. Living was slowing down big time.
I thought, of course, they wasted Buff's potential when they brought him back as a heel after that neck injury where everybody was crying over him. Dumb shit.
That was so brutal. Using that in the angle and everything was so brutal. And then they kept doing it over and over again, too, which got really annoying. And it's like, you know, you are tempting fate here, people.
Oh, and just the classic line from, I think one of those unintelligible Brian Alvarez interviews with Buff Bagwell where he says, you know, I was supposed to be The Rock. I used to think so.
Wait,
no, you're supposed to be
Flex
Cavana.
What?
Oh, man.
He said, I'm supposed to be The Rock. Then he talked about holding the TNA Tag Team Championship. Then he named for wrestle for TNA.
Right, it's true. It's both tag champions of the world. Oh, man. That interview is, you know, that's as bad as it was, is like awesome. I don't know if you guys heard the interview with Gilbert Melendez. All I can say is that motherfucker better never ever say shit about the audio quality of my show after he posted that interview with Gilbert Melendez. My God, he made us look like we're fucking got Howard Stern production.
Like we're on serious.
Yeah, dude.
The next match is.
And make sure you say when I said that on Wrestling Observer Live this Sunday.
Yeah, but you know the difference is between him and you? He actually had on Lizzie Valentine as Candy Kisses, did he not? So you got to do that. You can't have me on. You got to get her on.
Actually, she's supposed to be a good friend of David Lagana, so I need to call him a favor.
Okay.
All I know is she does more pole dancing than wrestling nowadays. If you're friends with her on Facebook, you know what I'm talking about. She's one of my favorite friends.
Core strength. She's got it.
Diamond Dallas Page defeated Kurt Hennig to win the United States Championship. Finally, I got it out.
And this was cool, and this was good, and being an old Kurt Hennig fan, and one of the reasons DDP got over is guys that would make him look good, and he and Goldberg actually had some good stuff.
Savage made him, in my opinion.
Yes, exactly, and again, even though he was kind of like, okay, here's this white trash, old-looking, you know, burlap sack because he's too many tans guy, and, you know, he was still the guy I remember saying, you know, Paul Diamond and, you know, Pat Tanaka, Bad Company, you know, all those years ago. It was like, it was just amazing to see him. But again, you know, Kurt Hennig was still awesome. God, Kurt Hennig was still awesome. But, you know, again, this helped him and all those other guys really help make Dallas Page. And it was a legitimately good match. Not a damn thing wrong with this match.
Yeah,
Dallas Page,
good.
He was one of those guys that, I think he may be the one person I'm surprised more than anybody that he got over. Just because I saw him as a manager, you know?
Well, I wasn't surprised he got over because he always had charisma and he always had some talent. I'm surprised he got as good as he did.
Yeah.
Because he was horrible when he first started.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He looked like an old dude, and he was in shape for the most part, old dude, but it was just like old dude starting wrestling when he's old. And I'll give it to him, you know, all that positive Page stuff and everything. I mean, whatever it is, whatever, drinking his own Kool-Aid. I mean, he worked really hard and fought through a bunch of stuff, and I know he takes, you know, he's ripped to shreds over the fact he would plot out his matches, but, you know, and that's shitty, but that's the time he came up in. And it was the best thing for him because, you know, he got over, he was a legitimate WCW star, and he was a very unexpected one.
And why is it wrong for him to do it, and it's okay for Randy Savage to do it? Every time it's just the same thing.
With what?
Every match he had, everything was scripted down.
Yeah, but Randy Savage was Randy Savage. And,
yeah,
you know,
well,
and he also came from an era where he didn't have to do that, but he was also, you know, Savage was also special crazy, too. It's like, you know, it's not like he was doing that with Waller in Memphis or anything, and, you know, he had plenty of matches without it. It was just, you know,
it's
and
like,
I know the Steamboat one's the most notable one, but it's, you know, I would trust him to call in the ring far more than DDP, and plus he had a pedigree, which DDP didn't. He had years and years of experience. He was a great athlete. I mean, you know, the Savage had a lot more going from the DDP.
I never understood the whole, like when people would say, like, all those years later, they found out that Steamboat Savage, like scripted out move for move, and then all of a sudden the match isn't as good as they thought it was. I never understood that kind of thinking. If a match is good, it's good. I don't care if it's scripted out, like, 1, 2, 3, 4, or point A to point B, or if it's called in the ring. It don't matter to me.
Because, you know, the reason why is, unless you were told it, you wouldn't have thought of that with Steamboat and Savage, and the problem was it became a thing where, and you know, I don't remember happening with DDP at all, but dudes forgetting, especially at this time, forgetting what they should do in a match, and then standing there looking lost, and it's, you know, they weren't pros being smooth going through motions. It was, you know, they just started to end up fucking up matches and having them fall apart, and just they were bad matches, and you could tell that it was choreographed and it looked like crap.
Next you had Larry Zbysko defeated Eric Bischoff in 11 minutes in a match for the control of Monday Nitro, and Bret Hart was the guest referee. Main thing I remember at this match is Bischoff loading his kick pad and the object going flying right out of the ring, out of his kick pad and into the audience before he connected with Larry Zbysko's head.
That was like that ultimate, that was like that Randy Savage fucking scepter thing.
Yeah. It was always, you know, this, the thing was Zbysko, and it was going to be, you know, when, how long ago when Spicoli died? You know, because
that was 98. That was about 13 years ago, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it was Zbysko being involved, which, you know, in obviously watching AWA at the bitter dying end and knowing that Zbysko was married to, you know, Great Gagne's sister, or not Great Gagne's sister. Yeah, she was a Great Gagne's sister, wasn't she?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's, or one of the sisters at least, but it was kind of cool in a way that it was like, and I always liked the disc. I know people hated him, but I always liked the stall and stuff like that, and sometimes it really would be too much, but I liked him. I remembered Scott Hall from, you know, and remember his AWA day, so in a way it was actually kind of cool that it was like, okay, even though you're smacking around the announcer, you're getting him involved, you're doing it with a flair of, you're remembering it came from the AWA. So I thought it was actually kind of a cool thing, and I didn't mind it whatsoever. And this was...
And Larry was over. Zbysko was so fucking over at that time.
Oh, yeah, and it's like the Road
as
Warrior
as far
pop.
As like the NWO versus WCW, Larry Zbysko was the most over part of WCW at one point.
Well, because people love chanting Larry, and it was one of those things where it kind of, in some ways, a Rogue Warrior pop thing where the Hawk would always go, yeah, you hear that? And Larry Zbysko always loves to say, yeah, they were here, they were chanting my name and everything. But it's just kind of how it became a part of the, you know, the change in the fans and a part of the show and everything. And the thing is, he carried it well. It was like, you're not going to push me around, motherfucker. And, you know, he would push back, and, you know, Bischoff smacking him in the face. And it was good stuff. And Scott Hall, you know, teasing him with old man, you know, remember back when you were something old man and I was just starting up, and, you know, it was kind of cool that they, in the way that they did it, so I didn't have any beef with it. And then the thing with this was Bret Hart, you know, it was his first appearance, if I'm not mistaken, was for this match.
Yeah, he'd made like one appearance, he had debuted like on Nitro, and then they set this match up with him as a referee. I don't know, I thought it was kind of a waste after that. All that big stuff out in Montreal and stuff, and, you know, he comes in just like as a guest referee. I don't know.
Well, and that's the, you know, the thing is, too, him coming in is like, you know, what side was he on? Because, you know, the day after Montreal, they're all standing out there singing, you know, Oh Canada, the entire NWO's out there with little Canadian flags and all that stuff, and it was like, you know, they're going to court him and he's coming in, and then, you know, ends up being, you know, Brett saves the day kind of thing for the good guys.
Yeah.
Then we go to the main event. Sting defeated Hulk Hogan in 12 minutes, 54 seconds by submission to win the WCW World title. I still don't know what happened in this match. I have no clue.
It's when dumb things go wrong. Well, I don't know if it goes wrong, but, you know, Sting, you were debuting Bret Hart before this anyway. It was just so obvious that it was, you know, Bret Hart didn't have to go out there and do anything, although it made sense to, but if it wasn't going to lead to Hogan and Bret, they shouldn't have. But it was just, you know, Nick Patrick.
I think he just had a brain fart or something like that.
Or was, you know, was, I don't know, anything with Hogan or anything like that. But it was just, the whole thing became clunky and shitty. And realistically, all they needed to do for this was have somebody else get Patrick out of the match, even if it was Bret Hart, and that was it. And another referee would come in, and Sting just won clean. You know, heaven forbid that they could do something like that. But it was like this whole lead up, it was almost the reverse of when, I don't know.
I'm very upset because I see our other co-host is on Facebook right now. He was busy, too busy to call in, but he has time to go and like people's photos. What's up with that?
Maybe he's on
his
phone.
He just said he got back. Got back my ass. It's only like 7:30 there.
Good on you, Greg.
Yeah. Continue.
I don't know where we were.
In the main event.
All I know is we were sitting there, I was in college, we were at this house we were in, and we were sitting there and we saw Hulk Hogan wicks him in, boot, leg drop, 1, 2, 3. Good. Okay.
Wait, what was the match again?
Sting and Hulk Hogan.
Okay, Sting and Hulk Hogan. This is a match that they built for fucking, like, how long?
A year.
Yeah, over a year, where Sting was basically up in the rafters and not saying a goddamn thing for a year. And basically, I guess you could say this is the, basically where they killed the company, really, or from the downfall.
Beginning of the
this
end.
This is like their David Von Erich dying.
Yeah. Or Kerry winning the title in 84, and then just like, okay, now what? I mean, there was, you know, they screw up the finish. It was a cluster, and watching, everybody knew it was a cluster, and then it just sucked. And then there was no follow up to it that was any good, because it's not like, you never felt like WCW got their pound of flesh, and it was very disingenuous for Harlem Heat, and everybody's all happy at ringside, and they're happy with Sting and with Brett, and it was just like, no, the end of it sucked, this sucked, and then where they went with everything sucked.
Yeah, we were watching, and it said, the man just got beat clean as a sheet. You know?
Yeah, exactly. And this, I don't know, they call it a symbolic end of WCW, but really, you know, that it's amazing how it worked out for WWF, you know, with Brett leaving and McMahon becoming Mr. McMahon and everything. That was just like, you know, that whole worm just turned so incredibly fast, and this was the symbolic end for me of WCW in a lot of ways, because it was everything starting to come to roost there, and then it just got worse from there. Even though 97 or 98 may have been a huge year, but it was all downhill from there.
This has kind of killed Sting off in one night, this old match right here.
Yeah.
For me and you.
And even Brett, because Brett looked incompetent.
Yeah.
You know, does anyone remember Sting got the match when you won the match with the Scorpion?
Say that again?
Well, does anyone remember Sting won the match with the Scorpion and made him tap out? I mean, good on Hulk Hogan, who always, you know, makes you forget on how he lost a match or how it didn't mean anything when he lost a match.
Mm-hmm. Go to the next year. Starrcade 1998 in Washington, D.C. Actually, this started off, this was the best match on the show. It was a cruiserweight champ Billy Kidman beat Rey Mysterio and Juventud Guerrero in a triangle match when he pinned Guerrero. That was an awesome match. And then he did, like, right after an impromptu match with Billy Kidman, and he pinned Eddie Guerrero in 10 minutes. So it's kind of like the Billy Kidman show right here.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome.
Yeah, it surprised the hell out of me because, you know, both of the matches were good, and obviously, you know, all four of those dudes at the time were, you know, pretty awesome together. And just, Billy was coming out of the whole Raven thing and everything, and he was, you know, becoming a legit singles guy. You know, it was, you know, pretty established with it, but it was a real surprise. Yeah, they did this with Billy Kidman on when everybody was hurt too in '99. They always tried to figure out a way to build around Billy Kidman because he had so much talent. And he had a mouth and, you know, obviously had a hot girlfriend and everything, but it was just, it's too bad size didn't work with him. And, you know, and again, got a bad rap a little bit by getting pushed in the way he did with Hogan and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, Kidman at this time was really cool. And again, who did a shooting star press?
Not too many people, but I remember when he was just a jobber on Saturday Night TV.
Yeah, that and Worldwide or something like that.
I remember,
Kevin
Sullivan fucking squashing the shit out of him one night.
Yeah, remember they had guys like, you know, because Smiley was in the next match, and they had guys, it was like Doc Dean, and you could tell him and Smiley had worked together too, but it was Smiley, it was Doc Dean and Kidman. It was like, I remember when they were on, it was just like, this is the most generic looking team I've ever seen. And then he went over to join the Flock, and it was like, yeah, like, this is going to work. And damned if it didn't. And he became a legit star for me, you know, just being the guy who itched himself a lot.
And the next match, you had Norman Smiley beat Prince IK in 11 minutes. Why this is on Starrcade, I have no idea.
Because it's
Norman
Smiley, that's why.
Shit like that.
Norman Smiley is one of the greatest fucking people ever in history of the world.
I'm glad everybody thinks so. He did
Who
the
doesn't
big
love
wiggle.
The big wiggle?
The big wiggle. Remember when he used to scream like a little bitch, too? That was fucking hilarious.
Only time he was awesome was when he had Ralphus and they went to those backyard wrestlers and telling them they shouldn't do this hardcore stuff.
He's in the shoulder pads and everything. Terry Funk would come out. I'll say this about Norman. I was happy that he was even doing the schmuck thing. Because it's like, you know, good, this guy's getting paid because he's one of those guys where it's like you watch him and they have, like, legitimate wrestling skill and they work a different style, but you can respect them and it's like you know they're professionals. But, you know, in their role, it's like, you know, Norman Smiley, nobody gives a shit about him. So to see him big wiggle and actually get some love out of it was like, you know, good on him. It was like seeing LaParca bring it over in WCW despite them.
Didn't he do the screaming gimmick when he was doing the hardcore stuff? Screaming Norman
he'd be all like wearing like a bodysuit of armor and still be screaming like a little bitch.
Yeah, the best payoff to the Pepe storyline because he threw him in the wood chipper out in the back in the Nitro.
The only time I ever hated Norman Smiley was when he did that son of a bitch.
And you know the crazy him and Eddie Norman and Eddie Guerrero had fucking matches at that time too.
Eddie was a bad guy,
and that was actually good stuff.
Perry Saturn pinned Ernest Miller in 7 minutes. Why this is on Starrcade again, I don't know. I hated Ernest Miller. Terrible.
I hated Ernest Miller, except when he started doing the goddamn dancing gimmick and shit. That shit was awesome.
When I hated him the most, he was irritating as hell.
He was awesome, dude. I love that, dude.
This is what happens with a lot of racist people in WCW.
He got James Brown to come to a WCW fucking pay-per-view, dude.
Come anywhere. WCW paid James Brown about $75,000 probably to come there.
Yeah, but he showed up with the death of the cat in his red shoes.
Yeah, and they.
Kevin Sullivan talking about that because I actually looked because they were teasing him and he'd never show up and then he actually rolled out there and he actually had the Funk on a Roll song, which was his new song, which was actually pretty good. And he rolled out, and that was actually pretty awesome. Now, nobody will ever remember that he was facing the maestro, Gorgeous George III, with Ryan Shamrock, you know, was in his corner, and the maestro passed out during all that. But, you know, I actually liked Miller at that time. They just, I know he was one of Bischoff's boys, but they just, it was too much of him. Somebody call my mama and I'm going to turn my back and then I'm going to give you 5 seconds. Like, that stuff was all cool, but then they just would not let him shut up.
There's a problem with WCW, all those racist people down there, and then they get lawsuits filed against them, so they got to put all these Ernest Millers and Stevie Rays in prominent positions on TV.
It's also Miller's fault that Don Fry never got hired in WCW back in the day.
I mean,
Miller should be happy he just survived the Glacier days.
Okay, here's one, Ed, you cannot defend. Brian Adams and Scott Norenby, Pitt Finley, and Jerry Flynn. Why this is on Starrcade? Defend it.
Okay, wait, who was the match? It was Jerry Flynn.
Brian Adams and Scott Norton beat Pitt Finley and Jerry Flynn.
Okay, you got me. I can't defend this one, dude.
New Japan. That's the only way I can.
This is one of the worst, you know, stretches of matches.
You know, you could add 3 stars if you just would have changed the last name to one of the guys. You know, had Jerry Lynn in there instead of Jerry Flynn.
Yeah, I guess.
But
you don't like Lightning?
That's it. That's what that nickname was.
The next match you had, WCW TV champion Conan beat Chris Jericho via submission. Now, I think this is when Jericho was deciding if he was going to go to WWF or not, because he was starting to get beat a lot.
Yeah, and then it was kind of weird after this, too. They ended up, he beat Booker T for the TV title with help from, like, the Giant, who was still smoking cigarettes at the time or something like that, too. There was all that wackiness because they actually had him win and keep him happy on the way out.
Yeah, and then also, like, when that was going down and it looked like he was leaving and then they had him, like, that. They had that one match with Saturn to wear the dress, and it looked like he was, you know, since he was leaving, it looked like it was Jericho that was going to end up wearing a dress, but it was Saturn that ended up jobbing and having to wear the dress after that.
Which was always good just to hear Perry Saturn yelling to the camera, life's a drag.
It was weird, though, that whole period with Jericho is because they would push him and then de-push him and push him and de-push him. That whole time they were, like, negotiating with him. It was weird. He'd drop and then he'd go over. He'd drop, he'd go over. It was really weird, but Jericho was also one of the other most entertaining things at that time. I mean, the greatest thing ever was that fucking when he did the Spinal Tap and he couldn't fucking find the fucking the ring. He kept going outside and everywhere, and then they brought in the fake little Goldberg and shit. And then, you know, he was slapping the little Goldberg around, and then the little Goldberg speared him and he screamed like a bitch. That was fucking awesome.
And that was one of the few T-shirts I wouldn't be embarrassed to wear was the Monday Night Jericho one, which I still have somewhere around here.
I just don't remember him. He's trying to find the entrance to the building or something, and the door's supposed to be locked, and he pulls it, and it's open, and then he slams it back and has to act like it's locked.
That's
what Prophet's been told the whole time. I mean, it was awesome.
In the next match, you had Eric Bischoff pinned Ric Flair in 7 minutes.
Yeah, I pretty much blocked this out of my memory banks.
The heart attack angle a few weeks earlier.
Mm.
That was terrible.
Yeah, it extended up the Henning Flair thing, too, which, you know, unfortunately never went anywhere either, which was really disappointing. Yeah, and then I think it was Flair and Bret Hart, actually, after this, too, which was, I think, one of Bret's first big singles thing, which ended up being a way too short of a match on, I think, a Clash of the Champions. There was another pay-per-view.
No, that was the year before. Well, it was at the beginning of 98 when Bret came in 97. And they had, like, a match that sold out.
Yeah, we're on 98 now,
yeah.
Aren't we? Sorry about that. This all runs together for me, too. This is when I really started going back to WWE.
And I remember they did the best stuff with Flair and Bischoff, of course, is that first interview when he came back, like, in September. He cut that awesome promo. And then he won presidency of WCW, and remember when they were in Minnesota and he put him outside in the dunk tanks and people were throwing, you know, like the baseball trying to dunk Bischoff out there in the, like, 20 degrees in Minnesota or something.
That's right.
And then Bobby Heenan, he couldn't hit the mark, so he just he kind of, he acted like he slipped, and he slipped right into the, like, little thing you throw the balls at and dunked him. So that was some good stuff. The next match, you had Diamond Dallas Page pin the Giant in 12 minutes. This had an awesome finish. It looked like the Giant was going, like, for the choke slam off of the top rope, but DDP turned it right into the Diamond Cutter and beat him 1-2-3.
And I think that was Giant was getting spray painted and booted by the NWO not long after that, and I think he showed up at Valentine's Day Massacre, I think it was the
yeah.
next year, where he busted out on Austin and everything. So, yeah, it was, this was, I think, the thing that led to the end, which was losing to DDP, the NWO arch rival.
The next match, you had Kevin Nash pin Bill Goldberg in 11 minutes to win the WCW World title.
Didn't Nash just have to beat everybody at some point? Like, he had to, you know, get Goldberg there. You had Lance actually starting to get over with all his fucking titles and putting the shit title, and then he had to fucking job him out for no reason. I mean, this was when Nash was out of control just being a fucking asshole.
This is the Booker at this time, right?
Yes. And the thing was, too, I don't know, I'm in the minority in saying that I was fine with the streak ending, because I really was. I was getting kind of sick of it, and it was annoying, and really, there were WWE fans, and, like, there were fans that were just, they were kind of really sick of the streak, which I'm fine the streak ended, but it was how it ended being so shitty that it was just like, come on. And then the next night, you know, or a couple nights later, whatever it was, and no, it was the next night in Atlanta or wherever, where they had him run out, and the Falcons and Jamal Anderson's there and all that stuff, and they have him getting embarrassed.
Oh, the finger poke, like, of doom.
Yeah, the rape angle, and, you know, where the Elizabeth said he touched her and all that nonsense. It was just like, man, it's fine it ended, but he didn't need to get hit with a shock stick. Or so. It was just, it was a really crappy way to end it. And then the way Monday was even worse.
It took him 30 minutes to cross the street from the police station to the Georgia Dome.
Oh, yeah. And for him to come out and get embarrassed in the Georgia Dome, it was just like, wow, you know how to do everything wrong. And then, you know, to see it in hindsight, it's even worse. Somebody should write a book about that.
Yeah.
The other show was their David Von Erich dying. This was their Mike dying.
I don't know about that. No offense
to
anybody.
Yeah, but that's still kind of, you saw the family where you saw Fritz in, like, a different light and not being the good old Christian dad and more of a fucking asshole.
This was another nail in the coffin. This was their Starrcade 97
Part 2.
This was
a heart attack angle.
This was Starrcade 97 Part 2. You know, just another shitty Starrcade, which they were already about to go downhill anyway, you know.
It was in a long line of just shitty pay-per-views, too, where it was like, you know, buying these pay-per-views every month and dropping, you know, whatever it was, $29.95 at the time, and it's like, why am I paying money for this?
Yeah. I mean, you know, you always have people say they never, ever should have beat Goldberg. Well, eventually you got to lose sometime. You know, that's just, or else people are going to get bored with it. I don't think they should have done it with Kevin Nash. Maybe they could have maybe made another new star or something like that, beating Goldberg, I don't know. But whatever. It's kind of
Kevin Nash doing it, or doing it in a diabolical way, okay, that makes sense because Goldberg was such a monster. But again, it was so clusterish, and then you have all the, you know, as soon as you see guys, you know, cops in masks, you knew something was going to be, and it was just like, really, they use a taser, they use a shock stick on them. And then it was so over the top. And then again, to follow it up the next night where you go, okay, there's going to be some comeuppance here, you know, for Kevin Nash, and then it ends up being, you know, Hogan returns, and by the end of the show, it's like, there's that, you know, the new NWO is back together, and they're shocking with the stick 9 million times. It's just like, come on, this is so over-the-top goofy, it's not even funny.
And this was kind of, I mean, to me, it was kind of like the death of Goldberg, because he never got anything, any comeback or anything after this. Kind of just, he lost, and there wasn't anything after that.
No, there were a couple. Yeah, there were a couple things, but yeah, the mojo was gone.
Let's see, this Starrcade 99 is December 19th in Washington D.C. This was when Vince Russo was colluding business. Anyway, the first match, Vito LaGrasso and Johnny the Bull, the Mama Lukes, beat Disco Inferno and Lash LaRue. They had some horrible stuff on these shows back then.
I actually like the Mama Lukes. They're actually cool.
You got anything to say, Mike?
No. No, except for Lash LaRue always kind of made me laugh.
Medusa picked Evan Courageous to win the WCW Cruiserweight Championship.
This is what she had, like, those fucking, like, I don't know if you could get implants any bigger than she had at that time.
Oh, that was ridiculous,
This was when
she always had big titties, but she went up, like, fucking five sizes.
She still does the monster truck stuff, I think.
Yeah, I think she
still
does.
Is he still with the dude who used to play with the Bengals?
Yeah, I can't remember what his name was, but yeah, I know she's married to a like former football player or something.
Well, I know this is going to sound awful to say, and I don't mean it. I guess, but he also got popped for steroids too, didn't he?
Not sure.
Nothing to do with anything, but I always liked Medusa, even like back in like AWA days and everything. It was just like. It was so brutally bad too. The over the top bowling ball, you know, type tits, and you know Oklahoma pouring that all over. But the whole feud was Courageous, where she was gonna like you know bait him in because she wanted to beat men, and she like kind of like black widowed him in, and you know stole the title from him by kissing him. And didn't that how it happened where she was like kissing him and then laid on top of him and got the pin or something like that?
This whole period, this shows you how bad wrestling got because even I can't remember some of this shit.
And it was worse than the fact that there was so much stuff far worse than this is mind-boggling.
Yeah. WCW Hardcore Champ Norman Smiley pinned Mean. Don't remember that. Shane Douglas, Dean Malenko, Perry Saturn, and Asia beat Jim Duggan and the fucking Varsity Club we had here in 1999. Now, I like the Varsity Club, but bringing them back, nobody going to give a fuck about the Varsity Club.
Who was it?
It was
Kevin Sullivan, Michael Sund, and Rick Steiner with, what was it? It used to be Kimona Wanalea. I can't remember what her name was here. Leia Meow or something like that.
Yeah, Leia Meow, yeah. I mean, with Kevin Sullivan playing, like, over the top the role of, you know, the double secret probation and those guys doing lines from National Lampoon, it actually kind of made me laugh. And then, it was so over the top with her jumping on the trampoline with the pom-poms, and it was so over the top. And again, they were pros, so I didn't really it
so
didn't
awesome.
Really bother me at all because I did like Sullivan.
Jim Duggan was the janitor, and then found the TV title and became the TV champion.
Yeah, after Scott Hall threw it away.
He was awesome. Duggan was. You know what? Duggan was awesome at this period. I fucking marked out for him. Plus, he was like battling cancer and shit.
Vampiro beat Steve Williams by DQ in 5 minutes, and then he got a match with Oklahoma at Ferrara and pinned him. This whole Oklahoma thing, I thought that was kind of disgusting.
Oh, it was sick. And I remember seeing Steve Williams, and it's like, you know, by that point, you knew a lot more than you did before in 97. You know, you had access to so much more information. It was like, I know he needed the money and he had his own issues and stuff like that, but it was so shitty. And it was just a reminder of how shitty wrestling was, where that's a great friend of a guy. That's a guy that was brought in underneath your friend's, you know, push.
Yeah.
And to have him team up with Oklahoma doing the Bell's Palsy thing and making fun of the Sauce, it was just so shitty.
That was just a hateful thing to do.
And especially the whole thing with Vampiro and Jerry Only and the Misfits, it was all shit.
Why do people in power have to hate fucking Jim Ross, dude? It's like they did it. I mean, you know, it's
everybody else
shitty.
Likes him and respects him. And they don't
get it. We're talking about how bad this was. I mean, in all honesty, the WWE's done worse to them. You know?
I don't know.
I mean, unfortunately, the guy has had to put up with a bunch of bullshit
yeah.
his whole life
and
fucking mean spirited people who have to fucking make fun of a fucking medical condition that he has.
At least,
you know?
At least with this one, Oklahoma thing, at least Jim Ross wasn't in the same company, I guess.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but it was even worse because it's not like they even had enough guts to do it to their face where you give him the choice, you know. He's taking the money now, and he doesn't give a shit because they're paying him well. But it's just like, you know, it's a shitty thing to do now. But back then, I mean, because, you know, yeah, I know people hate him because he was the hatchet man. Well, that was his job. He was the guy
yeah.
who breaks the bad news. And he, talent relations and NWC, I mean, he, yeah, I'm sure he got enemies over the years. But treating him to the level that people did and the fact that people let it go, is, especially at that time, was gross. And, you know, and no respect for Steve Williams, you know, standing along with it. It's just, it was a shitty thing to do.
Yeah, and it's not like Jim Ross was the guy making all these decisions. These decisions are coming from the top. He's just, you know, telling people what the decision is. I mean, he's not the one doing it, you know. So anyway,
imagine what anything would be, you know, without, especially WWE, if he didn't bring in Brock Lesnar and Shelton Benjamin and recruit, like, you know, football players and actual, like,
yeah.
amateur wrestlers who know what it's like to work, you know, and work hard and stuff like that. It's amazing how they treat him for all he did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Next you had Kurt Hennig and the team of Creative Control, which was Patrick and Gerald, beat Harlem Heat and Midnight when Patrick and Gerald Creative Control, that was the Harris twins, when Don Harris pinned Booker. But they called him Patrick and Gerald, you know, like Pat Patterson and Jerry Briscoe.
Yeah.
I remember they called Vincent Chain.
Yeah. And look, I got to say this. My brain was breaking at that point, and there was a lot of partying going on and stuff like that, where I'll say this. There was something to be said about some of the fresh change and the fact that everybody kind of had a gimmick. You know, it wasn't any good, but in a comedic way, when you chucked your brain and tried not to think about wrestling and you saw some of this random shit, like Jerry, you know, Thunder or Lightning Foot all of a sudden wanted to battle in the Block, you know, because they were stealing that, you know, Fight Club stuff, and everybody had this, it was so ridiculous, the bell, you know, the lights would turn out, you'd hear the gong, and Midnight would show up defending Booker T. It was like some of the most random shit you'd ever seen in your life, and if you like drugs, Nitro was a great show to watch.
Yeah, I was on drugs at the time, and it's still fucked.
See, where you screwed up, was you had to watch Raw live, because this is what killed me about WCW and Turner too. So they have it on, and then immediately have a replay for the West Coast. So it's like, why would you want to watch it live? You just watch Raw live, and then just catch the replay if you wanted to. And that's when WCW was at its best. It's like 1 o'clock Eastern time, when you're really messed up.
The next match, you had Jeff Jarrett and Dustin Rhodes in a bunkhouse match. This was probably pretty decent, if I remember.
Yeah, I think it was, but I think it was just my bias towards those guys anyway, because I liked them both, although Dustin at the time, that was after the Seven stuff, how they were going to introduce him. They did all these vignettes leading up to
it,
and Russo took over. And I'm not sure what the deal
was.
It was
kind of bad at the time, too.
Yeah, I mean, it just wasn't happening, and it was like he was Goldust for so long, and then I think that was a Bischoff thing. He was going to bring him in as Seven, I think the name was, and then it just got, you know, Russo was going to strip it down because we do reality, and, you know, I guess in a way it was a good thing if they would have gave Dustin something good after this, but he looked like shit. He was kind of going back to
being Powder. How was him looking like Powder fucking reality?
Oh, well, no, it was him taking it all off in the middle of the ring and saying, you know, and cursing because it's a shoot promo.
Can people look at what the hell I'm wearing? I look ridiculous.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
But so if he would have followed it up with something, that he was going back to kind of being the natural. He was just going back to being Dustin Rhodes, big old Texan. It shit to bed, but then again, you know, at that point in his life, too, I don't think it was a real high moment.
Yeah. If you had Diamond Dallas Page pin David Flair.
Oh, this whole thing sucked.
I don't remember anything about this. I remember Flair was talking Kimberly or something.
Yeah. It was just so gross. The whole thing was, because to watch Ric Flair watch his son get, like, slapped in the face and beaten up and everything, it was just, like, it was so sad. It was just really pathetic to watch, and it was uncomfortable to watch. And, you know, for that little bit of time where David Flair was, you know, teamed with Crowbar, and they were crazy, and they that, for that 1 second, like, when you roll out, like, that was cool, but everything else he did was just, it actually gave me an uncomfortable feeling of, like, this is really pathetic. And then to find out more of the details later on, you know, of both of them, where they were at, it's like, it's even worse.
And we're probably going to be reliving in TNA here pretty soon with with Garrett Bischoff. I just think David Flair on Garrett Bischoff, so.
Now you got to bring Reed in for that one.
Oh, God. Sting defeated Lex Luger via DQ. I don't remember why these guys were wrestling. I don't even remember what was going on at this time.
I just remember Ric Flair and Lex Luger for a short period of time as, like, was it Team Package?
Yeah.
Team Package.
Oh, I remember this was awesome because Elizabeth had, like, turned on Lex and gone with Sting. And he had given her, like, the hairspray that she had been using and said, I want you to, you know, here's your weapon or whatever. And because Sting, for once, kind of got wise to somebody turning on him. So instead of actually hairspray, he gave her silly string. So he had the scorpion on Luger, and then she jumps in the ring to spray the hairspray, but it was like that silly string. So at least there was one turn this thing was kind of wise to, instead of the other 50 times he'd been screwed.
Awesome. Oh, also, I totally had forgot about that too. You brought it up, but that was awesome.
Then we had Kevin Nash defeated Sid Vicious in 6 minutes and 58 seconds in a powerbomb match with one of the all-time worst finishes. The ref goes down. Sid Vicious powerbombs Kevin Nash. There's no ref. Nash gets up, and I think he hits Sid Vicious with a foreign object or something. Vicious goes down. The ref gets up, and Kevin Nash said, I powerbombed him. See, he's down. The ref rings the bell and awards the match to Kevin Nash.
Jesus Christ, man.
That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
I just remembered that. Remember when they banned Kevin Nash, or they banned the powerbomb? They totally, like, banned the powerbomb. And
yeah,
I remember they had
that for?
I just remember at that time they had a show here in town at the Alamo Dome, and at that on that Nitro, I saw three different people use the power bomb. You know, because you know that's when the Conan and all the cruiserweights were doing all kinds of shit like that. It's like, but they the whole show they kept announcing how the power bomb was banned, but yet they had no answer when fucking they used three of them right there on live TV.
Yeah, they do, like, the different variations, like a Tiger Bomb or something like that. And I think it was when the Giant had gotten, he had him up, he was going to powerbomb the Giant, and then lost his grip, and the Giant landed, like, right on his head or something
like
that.
Yeah, he did him like Triple H.
Yeah. Then you had WCWS champion Chris Benoit beat Jeff Jarrett in a ladder match, probably the best match on the show.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and this, you know, led into, you know, kind of, this was led in all the injuries, too, because was it, before this, they had the match where Jarrett faced three, it was Tito Santana, George Steele,
no,
and maybe it
was
Jimmy
the,
Snuka.
Yeah,
that was the next month, because the next month, Benoit and Jarrett were going to have, like, a triple threat theater match, like, three different matches, like, on a pay-per-view, so they forced Jarrett into, like, against George Steele, Tito Santana, and Jimmy Snuka in, like, three different matches. And Snuka did the super fly leap off the top of the cage, and Jarrett got a concussion.
Yeah, that's when Billy Kidman ended up beating the wall, and the Radicals left, and all that stuff, you know, had kind
that
of broken down after that.
When Bret Hart had the concussion, had to give up the title, and then Benoit won, and he gave it up the next night when he left. That was a wild period.
Do you remember them doing the double elimination tournament, you know, that was going on in Ming? It was like Medusa won, but it was like, okay, nope, so you're going to face Ming next or something like that. It was,
oh, that 32-man title tournament, that was terrible. then in the main event, you had WCW champion Bret Hart beat Bill Goldberg in 12 minutes.
via submission, except it's with the Montreal finish. Bret Hart got the sharpshooter in, and special referee Roddy Piper called for the bell. And it, the whole thing was because Bret still thinks Vince Russo is the one that did the thing at Survivor Series, so he wanted to make good. It's terrible.
I got to be honest, though, that next night, I think it was, it was the next night on Nitro where, you know, they were still doing the creative control thing where you never saw Russo. It was filmed behind his shoulder, and he just had the desk in front of him. And it was kind of actually, they did do a good job, I thought, throughout that show, because you kind of really didn't see it coming where, you know, it wasn't supposed to happen this way. And then, you know, you text Goldberg, who was helping, you know, trying to help him out, and they ended up with a Jarrett, Nash, Hall, Hart. It was like, you know what, you knew at some point they were going to try to re-bring back the NWO, and it was like, with Bret Hart in it, it was like, oh, okay, good. At least there's a guarantee that he's going to be in the mix. And then all of that shit went down where everybody got hurt, and then it became a big mess, and then it was over with before it started. Plus, I actually kind of like the black and silver NWO shirts.
Bill Goldberg. I blame Bill Goldberg.
Yeah.
And no one had to do a kick.
Yeah, kicking him in his head, which, you know, again, you know, it's the one thing you can say about Goldberg is, and he wasn't exactly safe. But then again, he wasn't exactly experienced either.
Where Piper pinned Goldberg to win the title for Bret Hart or something. It was a screwed up pinfall at the end.
And then Piper played into the next, and the thing was, Piper was a jackass the next night. Because, or was it this night where he laid on top of Goldberg or something like that? He was a schmuck at this point, in this whole thing with Russo too, and obviously he hated it and everything. But I remember he had some sort of, you know, Bret Hart the previous year or 97 type screw up somewhere along this line too, where it didn't make any sense.
Yeah, we've seen why this company is dead now. go to Starcade 2000, which would be the final one. And let's say you go from doing a 1.9 buy rate in 97, and on this one it's got a 0.11 buy rate.
Mm.
Damn.
That's a drop. Three count defeated the Young Dragons and Jamie Noble and Evan Courageous. With this, I didn't know who was in what. Three count, the Junk Dragon, Jamie Noble. What? Because Jamie Noble and Evan Courageous were in the other teams at one point, so that's why it confused me. Beat those guys in a ladder match in 13 minutes, probably the best match on the show.
Yeah, it was probably the best thing on the show.
I think it was too, actually. That was actually pretty cool. And again, you know, it was all downhill from there. And the other thing, too, was in D.C., I mean, there was probably 3,000 people there, and they probably didn't pay to be there too. In a 20,000 seat building, it was just so low rent.
Then the next match, you had two useless wrestlers. Lance Storm pinned Ernest Miller in 7 minutes and 24 seconds.
Yeah, two jobbers. Who cares about that match?
God, I love the Team Canada then too. This is.
Yeah,
I love the Saskatchewan Hardcore International title.
Yeah, the Lance Storm, he got a hell of a push. I mean, when he came in, won three titles in, like, what, about 3 weeks?
And then he got fucking jabbed out to fucking Nash in 5 seconds.
Yeah.
But, yeah, he was doing pretty good. And plus, didn't they have Major Guns for a while, too?
Yes, they had Major Guns for a while, too. And they had a shaved Hector Jim Duggan.
Yeah, that's cool.
Terry Funk pinned Crowbar to win the WCW Hardcore title. I don't remember much about this, but it could have been a decent match.
Anything with Terry Funk was decent.
Then you had Chronic went to a no contest with Big Vito and Reno. I have no idea what any of this is about. When somebody's dating somebody's sister's girlfriend or something like that, I don't remember.
And then there was some of the disc. The one thing cool about Reno came in and actually was one of the first guys, and he may have been the first guy to use his signature for using the roll of the dice, which I actually thought was a cool move, but it's just like outside of that, that was about it. I think Disco. There was, I think there was maybe a Disco thing at the time of, with Reno's sister or something like that. And Chronic, and Chronic at the time too, at least looks wise. I mean, it was cool them coming in. It was like Brian Clark always had an awesome look anyway. It was like maybe they could do a little something with this, and it just, and again, it was good for WCW at the time, but when you look back in 2020 vision, it wasn't that good.
Yeah, they're just two big dudes.
Mike Awesome beat Bam Bam Bigelow in an ambulance match.
Okay, Mike
Awesome.
I can't
remember what Mike Awesome was doing here. I can't remember.
He was doing,
bad
at this point, wasn't he doing the 70s guy?
Might have been.
Or was he still doing
the fat, around the time when Gary Coleman came in. This was the time when Gary Coleman came in. And he took
got that fucking guitar shot. Did Jarrett give him that fucking, or something? Who gave him the fucking guitar shot?
Jeff Jarrett, and but he had, but he was worried about it, so he put a roll of toilet paper in his hat.
Yeah.
And the had the Parker family bus.
That was awesome.
The lava
Mike
lounge,
awesome, dude. He was awesome in WCW. He was the best thing going, dude.
Remember when Bigelow first rolled in, and it was Bigelow, Nash, and Goldberg, and it was like, you know, something fresh to liven things up, and then, yeah, then you get Mike Awesome and Bam Bam Bigelow a little while later in an ambulance match.
WCW U.S. Champion General Erection. I still can't believe that name. Beat Shane Douglas via disqualification.
Yep.
I'm sure it was
that pretty over at this point. You know, they'd done the U.S. title thing with him and Lance Storm. So... he was okay.
Douglas is all broken down by this point.
Yeah. Jeff Jarrett, Ron, and Don Harris beat Conan, Rey Mysterio Jr., and Billy Kidman in 12 minutes in a bunkhouse street fight.
I can't explain to you why were these people meeting. I mean, I like looking at Tigress and all that, but I have no clue on how they got together other than I know the Filthy Animals were a thorn in Russo's side, and like the Harris brothers or something like that. It was just like, I forget who they were a thorn in the side of, that they wanted to, Jeff Jarrett wanted to beat them up, and I can't remember why.
The next match you had Diamond Dallas Page and Kevin Nash, the Insiders, not the Outsiders, the Insiders, defeated Sean Stasek and Chuck Palumbo to win the WCW Tag Team title. That Natural Born Thriller stuff, that was a bunch of garbage.
Ugh. Yeah, and I, you know, they all looked good, and, you know, Mike Sanders, actually, he made me laugh, especially because Madden would push, like, he'd do the finisher, and it was always, like, sneaky. I remember he stole Jeff Jarrett's guitar to get a win one time, and it was like, okay, right then you knew he was something a little bit different, and then all of a sudden he becomes the leader of this new group, and he's got the 3.0 because, you know, that's better than average, and that made me laugh. But it was like, you know, the rest of them, it just absolutely drove you nuts, and just it sucked. It sucked. Although Lex, again, DDP and Kevin Nash doing, you know, you're not allowed to mention Scott Hall, so they would do the promos where all they would do is mention Scott Hall over and over again. They'd have to bleep that out. It was actually kind of funny. It's sad in a lot of ways, but since it's not my money, I didn't care.
And they were looking at, there's like a light or something that was swinging, and they kept looking at the light. Looked like they were being hypnotized or something. I don't know what the deal was.
Well, then they started doing those face-off cameras, too, where we have guys look to the side. And it was actually kind of cool there for a minute, too, where they had Storm do it and they had some other guys do it, where it was like, that was actually kind of a cool concept for a minute.
In the next match, you had Bill Goldberg pin Lex Luger in 7 minutes. I expect this was horrible.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty shitty.
In the main event, you had WCW World Champion Scott Steiner defeated Sid Vicious in 10 minutes. I expect that was horrible.
I don't know. Scott Steiner, anything with Scott Steiner at this point, I mean, he was pretty awesome, so it's hard to imagine anything with him being in it being bad.
And at this point, this company, you know this company's dead. I mean,
yeah.
You know, there's always a big talk about them being sold or whatever, but this was... And this company was like on, this was in intensive care at this point.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Steiner was doing it. Steiner was one of the only good things. He had like Medeja and Shakira with him. I really like Shakira. I think Medeja was the one who wanted to keep being a wrestler, but Shakira was really hot. But in any event, he was like retiring guys. It was, he got rid of Goldberg, he got rid of Nash, he got rid of Vicious. It was like guys he was getting rid of, although I guess, you know, it was really the next month when Vicious disappeared, but they kind of, you know, put that one on Steiner too, where he kept retiring guys and who's going to be the guy to stop him. And I guess it really ended up being Booker T, although it was probably a lot sooner than they would have expected.
Yeah,
I forget what Kevin Sullivan always said. They were going to bring back, I think Goldberg was the guy they were going to bring back, rehab him and be the one.
Yeah. Yeah, I just remember the next month, at that next pay-per-view, Sid Vicious jumped off that second rope. That was like the worst thing I've ever seen.
Yeah, Theismann his leg.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's it.
Does this mean we're done?
Oh, my God. It only took 75 hours.
If you add all three shows, it's pretty goddamn close to it.
This is like old ages.
So we finally actually got through a subject that we've never actually been to, I don't think. But hopefully it won't take us three more shows to do other subjects. But I guess we'll go ahead and wrap up. Katrina, you got anything you want to talk about before we go?
No, you know, I was on Xbox Live the other day, and I noticed they got this YouTube application on there. Then I can stream all those YouTube videos from YouTube onto my TV.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I found like they got a world-class channel and a Memphis Wrestling channel. I just go on my computer and like subscribe to them, and they'll be on my Xbox. I've been watching the shit out of a bunch of old stuff. It's awesome.
That's pretty awesome.
Dude, record that shit before they take it down. Shh, nobody say anything.
Okay. So, Chad, do you got anything you want to talk about before we go?
Nah. No, I hope Craig is enjoying his night off.
He wouldn't let it go this long. He just tapped out.
Yeah, he just didn't want to make a fool out of himself. But I think he said he wants to actually try his 10 questions for Craig next week. So if you miss out on hearing Craig embarrassing himself this week, we will sure he'll do it 10 times over next week. Because I'm pretty sure he won't get one question.
Take on Chad so he can embarrass himself even more.
He says he says if anything's cool, just no WCW, I mean, World Class or Mid-South questions. It's like we could ask him a question from a year ago and he'd probably still miss it. So
I was going to ask him
we'll have some
Bisco questions.
But yeah, everybody come back next week and we will be back with Craig embarrassing himself. So everybody come back next week and we will talk to everybody then.
To be the man, you gotta beat the man. You wanna find out how good you are? You're looking at the matrix. Let's go hook 'em up.